Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
No more parties in L.A. Please, baby, no more parties in L.A. No more parties in L.A. Please, baby, no more parties in L.A. No more.
Los Angeles.
Please.
Shake that body, party that body.
Please.
Shake that body, party that body.
Please.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Over the past 14 days, the state has seen over 40,000 COVID patients admitted to the intensive care unit. That's a 10.6% increase, according to California Health Secretary Dr. Mark Galli, addressing the public in a press briefing less than an hour ago. Galli also announced that Southern California will remain under a regional stay-at-home order, which includes the ban of any gatherings with members outside of one's household until ICU capacity rises above 15% again. Now, for context, ICU capacity in the region is still at 0%. But despite that, the party doesn't stop. People keep gathering at large warehouse parties in places such as downtown LA, at sites with very poor ventilation where very few people wear any masks. It's really an ideal environment for the spread of the coronavirus. And despite a pledge from LA Sheriff Alex Villanueva to crack down on these parties, enforcement remains lax. Cerise Castle wrote about all of this for Los Angeles Magazine and joined us to talk about what this underground party scene is all about.
Well, the underground party scene hasn't really changed at all since before coronavirus. Before coronavirus, a lot of these parties were happening downtown. They're in warehouses that aren't zoned to be nightclubs. They're secret for all intents and purposes. You can only really get in if you know someone or you've been invited. And that setup has really played well to them during the coronavirus, having it be really insular. Now, the downside to that is because a lot of people have taken a public stand, a lot of influencers that had been populating those parties in the past have taken a public stand against going out and against these parties, they haven't been getting the foot traffic that they normally were. So in the past, where it would have been difficult to get into these spaces, now it's really a free-for-all. If you show up, you'll get let in.
Wow. So where are these primarily happening?
They're happening all over LA County. In my reporting, I focused on a group that has been throwing parties throughout the coronavirus pandemic in downtown Los Angeles. But I've also heard of a number of parties happening in the Hollywood Hills, at Airbnb rentals, as well as at single-family dwellings in the Valley, in the Van Nuys, Encino area.
So what about the people who are throwing them? What do we know about them and the effort to keep these parties secret? I mean, how have they been able to keep them under wraps if people might be looking out for them?
The thing about secret is they're not really so much secret. If you're looking for a party, you can find it. It's as simple as going onto Eventbrite and searching for, you know, Los Angeles party. Los Angeles strip club, Los Angeles bar. All these will turn up flyers and tickets for events. A lot of people have been telling me that they're getting email blasts from some of these promoters, and they have no idea how they ended up on these lists. A lot of these promoters share these lists with each other in an effort to get more people into the event and therefore more money in their pocket. So they're really coming at you from all directions.
Now, have the LAPD or the LA Sheriff's Department stepped up enforcement during this surge since you first started reporting this story?
What I have seen is the LA Sheriff, their super spreader task force over New Year's Eve, they broke up five parties. I believe they detained about 900 people and cited 90. Other than that, no. The regular promoters that I'm seeing throwing these parties and events, they are continuing to openly post about them on social media, really continue what they're doing. They're not afraid of the police stopping them. And from the way things have been going, they believe that law enforcement will not be putting a stop to what they're doing. The thing about these parties is a lot of them hire off-duty law enforcement officers to actually work security. So law enforcement is very aware, and even in some cases, participating in making these parties happen.
So is it like a consequence-free zone for the people there?
100%, yes. And I mean, there really aren't, right? As far as arrests go, we've seen 90 people get arrested, but, you know, those arrests don't always translate to prosecutions, right? In my reporting in the LA Mag story, I spoke to the city attorney's office, and they told me that while they are prosecuting several businesses for violating the health order, they do not currently have any cases against any individuals for gathering or attending these parties. So you might get, you know, a talking to by a police officer, but, you know, frankly, that isn't much of a deterrent for the people that are attending and throwing these events.
We're talking about underground parties in L.A. County with Cerise Castle reporting on these parties for L.A. Magazine. Any health precautions that the planners and partygoers are doing in attending these parties? Anything at all?
None. When you go to these parties, you'll see nobody's wearing a mask. Oftentimes, like you mentioned at the top, they are in very small enclosed spaces. Last night, I was watching the live stream of a party in Encino that was about 200 people in one room. People are sharing marijuana blunts. They're sharing other illicit substances hand to hand. It's basically a germ fest. You know, if you're going to get sick, this is really an environment that, you know, health experts have said is perfect for breeding COVID-19.
What's the range of attitudes by the people throwing and going to these parties? I mean, do they think the virus is a hoax, that it's not as dangerous as it is maybe portrayed in the media, or are they just sick of lockdowns and just want to go out and party?
When I've spoken to people about the virus, they are aware of its existence, but they really question the seriousness of it. A lot of people will tell me that they knew a friend that had it that was sick for a couple of days and was better. And to them, they see it as a risk that they're willing to take. They're not willing to sacrifice some of the normal things that they have been doing in their life for a public health effort.
And in a weird way, Cerise, is kind of the whole danger of it all part of the allure, especially going on during the pandemic?
A lot of the people that I've spoken to, they really don't think they're doing anything that crazy or dangerous at all.
That's Cerise Castle, who reported on the spread of large parties despite the coronavirus for Los Angeles Magazine. Cerise, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pandemic. They're getting tired of the pandemic, aren't they? Getting tired of the pandemic. You turn on CNN, that's all they cover. COVID, COVID, pandemic, COVID, COVID, COVID. You know why? They're trying to talk everybody out of voting. People aren't buying at CNN, you dumb bastards. They're not buying it.
Their symptoms run the gamut, from shortness of breath to heart palpitations to extreme fatigue. They have become known as long haulers, people who have been infected with COVID-19 but can't seem to rid their bodies of its effects months later. As the number of cases keeps climbing and surges around the country, it means more and more people will be struggling with similar problems. This medical mystery has the medical community scrambling. Stephanie Tsai has our report.
This is Greg Rosen trying to go for a short run a few weeks ago.
Just had to stop because I couldn't breathe.
This was Greg Rosen before COVID, sprinting to finish lines in marathons, road races, and relays across the country.
Even the other day, the act of folding towels left me breathless.
COVID has left me with some nasty migraines.
Baltimore middle school teacher Shamir Smith has spent the better part of the last 9 months in bed.
It felt like a ghost or a monster had started to inhabit my body.
And New Jersey father of three and guidance counselor Dane Tabano has terrible brain fog.
When it gets bad, I get like this buzzing and ringing in my ears, and my short-term memory is really poor.
And he's also struggled with tachycardia, elevated heart rate, since July. That makes it tough for the former University of Michigan wrestler to run his wrestling school.
If I actually stood in front of an athlete now and tried to work out with them in a wrestling practice, I don't think I could sustain more than 5 to 10 minutes at this point. But back when I was in the worst of it, I probably wouldn't even do 2 or 3 minutes.
These three previously healthy individuals are in their 20s, 30s, and 40s and are now suffering long-haul COVID.
For me, my experience has been intense acute illness followed by continued acute illness for months on end. So it's been about 6 months now that I've been sick.
Are you somebody that got sick a lot before?
No, I have no underlying health conditions.
I had no idea that in the course of 9 months that I would lose my vision or sometimes lose my ability to move my left arm and left leg.
By best estimates, nearly 23 million Americans are known to have had COVID-19. And of those, more than 375,000 have died. It's unknown how many of those 22 million others may suffer long-haul effects down the road.
There were many members of our group who were a couple of months into COVID and were not recovering, and in fact were sort of spiraling and down and getting worse.
We first met Diana Barrett last spring after she founded Survivor Corps, an online community for COVID survivors like herself that's now grown to over 125,000 members.
I am fully clear of the virus.
Back then, she didn't think she'd be calling herself a long hauler.
I had a good 6-8 weeks where I felt like I was really much better. And then over the summer, I had a complete symptomatic relapse. I was having tremendous gastrointestinal problems. I lost so much weight. I could not put it back on no matter what I did. I was diagnosed with COVID onset glaucoma at the beginning of September.
And she certainly didn't think her 12-year-old son, Spencer, who had a mild case of COVID in March, was at risk.
He was sitting on the couch watching television, and one of his teeth, his front adult teeth, spontaneously fell out with no blood loss. I immediately posted to Survivor Corps and said, has this happened to anybody? And the answers started flooding in of so many people experiencing spontaneous loss with no blood loss, cracked teeth, all kinds of dental issues.
There are tens of millions of people who are COVID survivors who may be carrying this vascular damage in their bodies with them going forward, and we can't leave those people behind.
Dr. William Lee is a vascular biologist studying the 60,000-mile network of blood vessels in each of us that connects every organ in every cell in our bodies, supplying them with nutrients.
We think this long hauler syndrome has a vascular component, which I study, a autoimmune component, inflammation, and also a neurological component. So this seems to be the three legs of the stool.
In March, he started studying lung tissue from people who died of COVID.
That beautiful lace-like architecture has been completely destroyed.
More recently, he's been looking at what COVID can do to the heart.
And on the right-hand side, you can see what happens in a COVID patient. When the virus infects the blood vessels in the heart, it completely destroys that normal architecture. This is sort of like I call this a kind of scared straight image.
It's like it reminds me of the image you see in the back of a cigarette box.
Exactly. Exactly.
Dr. Lee has also been able to use special imaging software to see more than a CT scan can capture.
Acute, the small blood vessels are really wiped out. This is living patients. Long-term COVID, better, but not fully recovered. And by the way, this patient's CT scan of their chest was read by the radiologist completely normal. This is not completely normal. And this particular patient went to get a scan because she was still short of breath.
So how is it the average person who says goes and gets a CT scan and doesn't have you, Dr. Lee, supposed to know whether they have this long-term damage?
This is what I'm working on. I mean, literally, this is like a new page of the textbook of medicine, because we need to get the word out that this is the kind of research that is being done to give people an answer that what they're feeling is in fact real.
This is a phenomenon that is really quite real and quite extensive.
Good morning.
At a 2-day virtual conference in early December run by the National Institutes of Health, one thing was clear. Doctors have more questions than answers about this medical mystery.
There's definitely still a lot that's unknown.
We are flying a little bit blind here. We're not exactly sure what we're looking for.
Wondering how much more of this I'll have to go through.
Shamir Smith has been through a barrage of tests, like this EEG, and often been told it's all in her head.
For the better part of 9 months, I spent time fighting for my life by myself and trying to get doctors to believe me. And it's been a harrowing journey. I do not want another Black woman to go into a hospital with these symptoms that go on and on and on and seem so never ending, and to be told that she's too smart to know about her body, or that she's too aggressive to take action on what happens to her health. I don't want that for anybody.
For Greg Rosen, months of debilitating symptoms without a clear diagnosis, prognosis, or even an idea of what lasting damage there is has been traumatizing.
These are the medicines I'm taking.
I feel like I'm fighting a battle against my body, but I'm also fighting a battle against the world right now. I think this is one of those things that even if I physically get well enough to feel more like myself, I think the emotional toll this experience has left on me will be something I never forget.
This is a situation where doctors need to listen to patients who are bringing their symptoms to teach us as medical community what's actually happening. It's the exact opposite of what normally happens where doctors are telling the patients.
Shamir Smith's persistence to find answers is paying off. A new diet and medication regimen is making her feel a little better.
On my darkest days, in the dark, no light in my room at all, when I couldn't even really see anything, I could not imagine a future for myself. And now I actually can, and I'm happy about that.
Well, this is a cliche too, but it sounds like it made you stronger.
Yeah, girl. Yes. I would say that. Don't have me crying up in here. Yes, absolutely.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Such important reporting. Thank you, Stephanie. And I know we're going to continue to follow this. What a story.
White supremacy is the sickness.
Operation Warp Speed may have produced effective COVID vaccines in record time, but administering them has been another matter. The CDC says only about 9 million of the more than 25 million doses distributed have actually been given. As John Yang reports, the Trump administration today made big changes to the program.
Judy, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar announced the changes. The administration will begin to release all available doses of the vaccine. It had been holding back roughly half because these are two-shot vaccines, but officials are now confident that the supply is sufficient. It's urging states to vaccinate anyone 65 or older and anyone with an underlying medical condition that could threaten their life if they get COVID. It will send more doses to states that are vaccinating people more efficiently, and it will encourage states to set up more places to get the vaccine. All this comes in advance of what's expected to be an announcement from President-elect Joe Biden of his vaccination plans. Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist at the Coronavirus Resource Center at Johns Hopkins University, and she joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us. Why make these changes, or why was it necessary for the officials to make these changes now? And were these the right changes to make?
Well, I think these changes reflect the fact that people are frustrated that vaccines aren't rolling out as quickly as it had been promised. I mean, you know, initially we had heard that by the end of the year, 20 million Americans would be vaccinated, and we are very far away from having achieved that goal. And so, you know, the approach that was initially taken, which would be to give the vaccine to the highest priority group, you know, I think is still an important goal, but it's a very slow, methodical, stepwise goal, and it's not going to achieve the vaccination numbers that I think people were very much expecting.
Is there a risk, or are there potential downsides to this new strategy?
Sure. Well, one of the risks is just that as we open it up broadly, we lose the ability to target what, you know, still limited vaccine supplies we have for the people that we, you know, think are either at highest risk due to exposure. And you can understand why that was an initial priority in a lot of places. Yet at the same time, there's still a lot of people, particularly those, you know, 65 and older, who are at greatest risk of becoming hospitalized and dying from this virus. So you can see the real tension and trade-offs there.
You know, we're sort of at an inflection point with the change of administrations, a chance to sort of rethink this whole strategy and perhaps make even bigger changes. Are there things in particular that you would urge the Biden administration or his people who are coming in to think about approaching this program differently?
Well, up until now, we've basically just focused on developing the vaccine. And, you know, the federal response was to develop the vaccine and just sort of hand it off to the states, give them some high level guidance, but basically say good luck. That it clearly has not achieved what we needed to achieve. And so now I think there is an opportunity to say, how can we have a national strategy? What federal resources can be brought to bear to help states with this very audacious goal of trying to, you know, conduct the largest vaccination campaign this country has ever done in modern history? So I think recognizing that the federal government can't just, you know, take a light touch on this issue and really needs to dig in and help states, because the sooner we get all states protected, the sooner, you know, our lives can, you know, get back to normal. We can restore our economy, et cetera.
You know, you work with healthcare workers at Johns Hopkins, and I wonder if you can help lay people like myself understand what seems to be sort of an oddity. The fact that there are, at least anecdotally, a large number of healthcare workers who are reluctant to take this vaccine. Help us explain that.
Sure. So this is something that we see every year. Healthcare workers, though they work in facilities that are, surrounded by science, they're regular people too, and they are subject to the same disinformation campaigns that are, waging against the American public to try to discourage them against getting vaccinated. So it's very much something that we have to, should have anticipated and should have planned for, how to boost confidence and to educate and to encourage people not only about the importance of getting vaccinated, the safety of vaccines and the benefits of getting vaccinated, but also, again, about the threat that this virus poses. And that's another dimension that, is somewhat new. You know, seasonal influenza isn't typically politicized at the same level that COVID-19 has. And, you have people who just openly deny the existence of the virus and deny it as a threat to them. And if people fall in those categories, you can imagine why they might not be so willing to get vaccinated.
And how concerned are you that a year into this, or almost a year into this, this nation still hasn't been able to sort of stem the roller coaster effect of cases, of new cases?
We are at the worst point that we've ever been. The case numbers continue to accelerate. The U.S. adds about 1 million cases at least every 4 days. So, that is extraordinary growth in cases. And you would think by this point we would have a better strategy for trying to control the virus. It's great that we have vaccines. It's a scientific gift that we have a vaccine now. But as you can see, the vaccines are rolling out slowly. And in the meantime, we still have to use the other measures that we've been trying to use for the past year to control the spread. We have to increase our testing. We have to make sure anybody who tests positive is able to stay home so that they don't infect others. We need to do more contact tracing so that we understand in what environments this virus is transmitting. And we need to make sure that anyone who's a contact of the case is able to stay home. Those efforts have largely ground to a halt as of late. And that's a really worrisome situation to be in, given the case growth that we've seen, and given the fact that we haven't yet seen the full effects of what the holiday gatherings will likely do to the acceleration of our case numbers.
Jennifer Nuzzo, an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
All them A's and them B's start to turn into C's. Go from crossing niggas over into running from D's. For you know it, coppers pointing at you, telling you freeze. And you can't afford a lawyer, so they telling you plead. Man, this shit worse than cancer, like a fucking disease. Living a nightmare, they telling his dream. Look what they did to Martin Luther, bullet holes in our kings. And they wonder why we never believe. And they wonder why we never will leave. Nigga, we poor. Young niggas worried about that corner store, but the chinks on that. And you claiming that's your block, who you think on that? Quicksand in the hood and we gon' sink on that. You should think on that. Poison water out in Flint, they let them little babies drink on that. They don't care about us.
According to multiple media reports, Michigan's former governor and other officials will be charged in relation to the Flint water crisis 7 years ago. Despite possible criminal charges, a lot of residents still question whether those officials will be held accountable. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody reports.
Nearly 7 years ago, government leaders here pushed the button that switched the city of Flint's drinking water source from Detroit's water system to the Flint River.
Here's to Flint.
Here's to Flint. Here's.
The intent was to save money. The result was a complete disaster. Improperly treated river water damaged pipes, which then released lead and other contaminants into the city's drinking water. 18 months later, the water was switched back, but the damage was done. Blood lead levels soared in young children. People were forced to use bottled water for drinking and washing clothes. The city was forced to rip out thousands of old pipes. While testifying about the Flint water crisis before Congress 4 years ago, former Governor Rick Snyder acknowledged the mistakes.
Local, state, and federal officials, we all failed the families of Flint.
Snyder was not among the 15 state and local government officials who faced criminal charges for their handling of the crisis. Half of them pled guilty to lesser charges in exchange for no jail time. And in 2019, Michigan's new attorney general dropped charges against the remaining defendants, citing problems with the original investigation. The investigation seemed over until yesterday, when the Associated Press reported that several former government officials, including former Governor Snyder, would be facing new charges. If that happens, legal experts say it would be a difficult case for prosecutors. Peter Hammer teaches law at Wayne State University in Detroit. He says despite possible difficulty getting convictions, it's important to bring charges.
Especially in an era where we're living where people are not being held accountable, this could be an important statement about the significance of the rule of law and that not even the highest public official in the state is going to get off scot-free.
A spokeswoman for former Governor Rick Snyder calls the reports of impending charges a public relations smear campaign, saying that if brought, they would be meritless. Since enduring 18 months of foul-smelling, dirty tap water that made them sick, Flint residents have demanded justice and compensation. A U.S. District Court judge is expected to decide in the coming days if she'll give preliminary approval to a massive settlement agreement resolving most of the thousands of outstanding lawsuits. Last year, the state of Michigan announced it struck a deal with attorneys representing Flint residents to pay $600 million into a settlement fund. A few months later, the city of Flint, a local hospital, and an engineering firm agreed to chip in another $41 million. Nearly 80% of that money would be set aside for plaintiffs who were young children or minors during the crisis. They are the ones most at risk for suffering long-term lead-related health problems. But a growing chorus of critics say it's not enough. A group of Flint civic and religious leaders, led by Pastor John McLean, gathered Monday outside the city's water plant to express concern about the settlement.
We believe that the proposed settlement, as currently allocated, is just as disrespectful as the injury caused by the water crisis tragedy itself.
In addition to tens of thousands of Flint residents, there are the lawyers, lots of them. More than 140 took part in a Zoom hearing with the judge last month. This is part of the challenge facing the judge, how to divide a large pool of money without leaving some feeling victimized again. Flint's mayor says it's important his residents have a belief in justice, and developments this week may help with that. For NPR News, I'm Steve Carmody in Flint.
Everybody grows big.
Let's turn now to a different impact of COVID on higher education. Typically, during a recession, community college enrollment goes up as unemployed workers start looking for new skills. But that is not happening now. It could mean trouble for the economy going forward, particularly for low-income students. Hari Srinivasan has our story. It's part of our ongoing series, Rethinking College.
Everybody goes through those days where they just feel like, well, maybe I should just stop and maybe I should just give up and maybe I should say, well, it's not even worth it.
It's been one of those days for Andrew Crowley, one of those years. He's been trying to focus on his studies at Columbus State Community College, but his mom died of cancer recently. He hoped to make more time for schoolwork by reducing his hours at Walmart.
And I try to explain to them, well, I need to cut back on some of my time so I can be able to study. And they really didn't, like, kind of agree with me on that.
So he says they let him go.
Which kind of led me to be homeless.
Crowley doesn't want you to feel sorry for him. He stuck it out. He even says he maintained A's and B's while living in a shelter during a pandemic. But he came close to being part of a troubling statistic this fall. Community colleges have seen enrollment plummet 10.1% compared to last year, nearly 21% among freshmen, and almost a 30% drop for freshmen who are either Black, Hispanic, or Native American in each group. The total loss at public two-year schools? More than 540,000 fewer students compared to last fall. Put another way, more than the population of Atlanta.
Our students have life.
Desiree Polk Bland, Columbus State's Vice President for Student Affairs, says some of her colleagues took it as a red flag when Crowley began to participate less in his classes. They persuaded him to share his troubles.
We're going to start putting that bread in there, okay?
Okay.
Then they got him a job at this campus-based food pantry and found him permanent housing.
All of these factors interfere with being a successful student. Anything that takes your attention away from going to class, studying, spending time with the material, ends up being a factor that impacts your ability to continue as a student.
56% of Black and Hispanic students have reported that COVID-19 is very likely or likely to force them out of school, compared to 44% of whites. The National Student Clearinghouse Research Center, which tracks college enrollment, says the drop among freshman students in particular this fall was unprecedented. Doug Shapiro is the executive research director.
These are truly staggering drops just in terms of the quantities, the size of the declines. College enrollments generally have been slowly shrinking every year, pretty much since the end of the Great Recession. But it's never been more than one or two percentage points. We've never seen anything like this.
Only 13% of students who drop out return to college, according to the group.
These are often the most vulnerable and disadvantaged students who will have real difficulties ever getting back on track educationally.
Okay.
There are the logistical challenges, like what Liliana Palafox faces, homeschooling and caring for her 6-year-old daughter without so much as a quiet space to study. That is, when the internet connection actually works.
The internet dropping, not connecting right away, having to move around the house to be able to get signal. And then also, like, my daughter or my husband sometimes using the hotspot, so we share it.
Then there are the deeper inequalities the pandemic has laid bare.
My father passed away due to COVID-19.
Tyler Lopez's father was already in the hospital with multiple sclerosis when the pandemic struck. He died of COVID-19 in the spring. Lopez tried to channel his grief into schoolwork. He's a sophomore studying jazz drumming at New Jersey City University.
Multiple times I thought about quitting. I thought about just forgetting it all.
Music kept him moving forward.
The drums, that's what prevented it. My love for music, it is hard, but the love outweighs the stress.
Schools are doing what they can to keep students enrolled. Lopez's school, New Jersey City University, is a campus where the majority of students are minorities, and many are from the lowest income bracket. The school provided loaner laptops and Wi-Fi hotspots for homebound studies, in-person classes for visual or high-touch programs, open dorms and libraries for those who need them, and socially distanced sports teams operating on a limited basis. But in a year like this, it hasn't always been enough, says Jody Bailey, the school's associate vice president of student affairs. Some students have simply disappeared.
I worry about them because of rent, and I worry about them because of food, and I worry about them because of the medical issues that their families have. We know that low-income and minority families in general don't seek out medical assistance as quickly as they should for a variety of reasons, and COVID could tear their families apart. I worry for them.
If my friends are doing it, then we should all take a break together, but...
Melanie Alvarez, a senior at California State University at Northridge, has felt nearly all of the pressure points, and one more. She was the first to graduate high school in her family, the first to go to college. All eyes have been on her.
The pandemic happened, like, I think my brother and my sister were all looking to me, like, okay, what is she going to do? Like, is she going to drop out? Is she going to stay in college? And it was hard to tell my brother, like, you know what, you have to push through, because I also felt at one point that I didn't want to continue anymore.
Alvarez says close friends and study partners have taken a break in recent months, but she decided to continue. The stakes seem too high.
My parents have always told me, you know, like, there's nothing that we can inherit to you other than the education, like, other than motivation, there's nothing that we can give to you. So my parents' motivation to, like, go to school is always, like, number one, and I'm always doing it for my younger siblings. So they're definitely, like, following my footsteps.
Her brother recently enrolled in community college, so for now, Alvarez says, she'll keep moving. The question is, how many others will get stopped in their tracks? For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Hari Srinivasan.
75% of traditional college-age students report poor mental health tied to the pandemic. We'll examine the impact in our Rethinking College series next Tuesday.
I don't want to cause any problems, Lieutenant. I just want a new partner.
Oh, I understand. Your partner's a racist prick, but you don't want to stir up any bad feelings with him.
Well, he's been on the force for a long time. And
17 years.
And I do have to work here, sir.
So... you don't mind that there's a racist prick on the force. You just don't want him to ride in your car.
If you need me to go on record about this, sir, I will.
That'd be great. Write a full report. Because I'm anxious to understand how an obvious bigot could have gone undetected in this department for 17 years, 11 of which he was under my personal supervision, which doesn't speak very highly of my managerial skills. But that's not your concern. I can't wait to read it.
Law enforcement officers were overpowered by that violent mob in the nation's capital last week. Disturbing videos show that police officers were kicked and punched and beaten with flagpoles. One police officer was killed and another later died by suicide off duty. but there were also a few police officers that appeared to sympathize with the mob. NPR's Leila Fadel reports that for current and retired black police officers, it was particularly upsetting.
Last week, Sharon Blackman Malloy watched her former colleagues try to stave off attackers at the Capitol, a lone black officer heroically facing a largely white mob as they first breached the building.
A lot of them felt like they were all alone.
Blackman Malloy is a retired U.S. Capitol Police officer and the vice president of the United States Black Capitol Police Association, which led a class action lawsuit in 2012 against the Capitol Police for alleged discrimination. She's also the lead plaintiff in the historic 2001 class action discrimination lawsuit against the Capitol Police Board. Her organization is calling for criminal charges against the sergeant-at-arms of the House and the Senate, as well as the former U.S. Capitol Police Chief who resigned after the attack.
Because they left them unprepared.
She's spoken to black police officers that were at the Capitol that day. They're traumatized. Some in the crowd called them the N-word. Some are injured. They're also scared because they saw a few of their white colleagues show sympathy with the mob. Several Capitol Police officers were suspended as the department investigates the attack on Congress. Among them, the officer who took selfies with rioters and another who popped on a MAGA hat and directed attackers around the building. Blackman Malloy says black Capitol Police officers told her this about Inauguration Day.
And then now you expect me to go stand beside an officer not knowing whether or not he's one of the terrorists. And that's what we deemed them to be.
There were some off-duty police officers from outside D.C. in the crowd. Police departments are investigating. And that's not lost on so many police officers around the country, particularly black police officers who face discrimination on the force. Carl Shaw sued the police division of the city of Columbus for racial discrimination and settled for $475,000.
You have good police officers and you have bad police officers. And in my case, if it wouldn't have been for white officers standing up and risking their careers, I wouldn't have had a leg to stand on. I just think we need to change the way we police and the hiring practices also.
The settlement, which conceded no wrongdoing, included a demand that the retaliation he faced for reporting racism by a superior be a fireable offense. Shaw retires next month.
If you're treating black officers this way, what are you doing to the general public?
Heather Taylor, a recently retired sergeant from the St. Louis Police Department, was texting with other black officers as she watched the attack on Congress. She thought about many of her fellow officers who made the assumption that Trump flags meant support for law enforcement, even when the crowds were incited by the president's lies and included hate groups. Meanwhile, Black Lives Matter protesters demanding racial justice were treated as hostile.
I don't know if they realize that these people who are extremists, who are militia, who are a part of these groups are about civil war. They want civil war. They want to do away with the government. And law enforcement has catered to them.
Taylor most recently headed the Ethical Society of Police, a St. Louis police organization that addresses racial discrimination in the police force and the community.
Okay, well, they're going to see that these people are going to turn on them, that the police are going to see that these same people that you supported over African-Americans in Black Lives Matter, you're going to see that it's different, that they're going to turn on you. And sure enough, it was worse than what we could ever imagine.
In Minneapolis, Metro Transit Police Chief Eddie Frizzell says he did more planning for the Super Bowl in Minneapolis than what he saw in the Capitol last week. Now he worries about the expected armed protests around the country this weekend.
I served in Bosnia right after the war-torn genocide had taken place, and we've seen what a tyrannical regime will do to a country in Iraq. And all those experiences are all coming to a head right now. It gives me a frame of reference to take my experiences and be able to aptly apply them to the unknown that we're experiencing right now.
The unknown that we're experiencing right now. Leila Fadel, NPR News.
You know, First Ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
Tech fallout from the riots in the Capitol has continued. As we reported, Twitter has instituted a permanent ban of the president's account.
Facebook indefinitely suspended President Trump from its platform. The company also said yesterday that it would remove all content mentioning "Stop the Steal," a phrase popular among supporters of President Trump's claims about the election. Apple and Google suspended the social media site Parler from their app stores. And Amazon said it would no longer provide cloud computing services for the network. We've talked about Parler before. Some have turned to the platform as a less moderated alternative to more mainstream social media companies. And some Parler users had been using the platform to organize before, during, and after the riots. The company said Parler wasn't doing enough to police content that incites violence. And through their combined action, they've made it impossible to download Parler's app through Apple and Google's app stores or log in via the internet. Here's our tech editor, Bodhi Atwaye, with more on how they made that decision.
Within the last week, companies basically sent notices to say, hey, is there a way, you know, we think that you guys need to clean up your act. Google and Apple specifically, and even Amazon to an extent, said, you know, we don't think your content moderation rules are sufficient that we can host you on our platforms. We have rules that, you know, if you have user-generated content, you have to do some level of moderation to make sure there isn't a ton of bad stuff on there. Parler replied to the companies and say, hey, you know, we actually do have content moderation rules, and we've actually been trying to do more moderation of late. But, you know, in essence, the companies proceeded with their decisions by saying, you know, hey, this, we hear you, but without saying specifically what steps to take, they said, you know, the plan that you guys have isn't enough, and we just can't have you on our platform anymore.
Now, Parler is suing Amazon, saying their actions are politically motivated. They said Amazon applied a double standard to Parler compared with other platforms, and they accused Amazon of trying to reduce competition in the microblogging market to benefit Twitter, with which Amazon recently signed a multi-year web hosting deal. For their part, a spokesman for Amazon Web Services said the claims had no merit and that it respected Parler's right to determine what content it allows. But he said Parler had shown that it was unable or unwilling to take down violent content, which is a violation of Amazon's terms of service. Needless to say, there are a lot of questions about how all this will play out, particularly as lawmakers have already been looking at social media companies' roles in the online marketplace. So here to talk more about this is our tech policy reporter, Ryan Tracy. Hi, Ryan. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the things that Parler has said here is that these actions are politically motivated. And conservatives have long been accusing social media companies of trying to rein in free speech and more strictly moderating them than more liberal groups. Do these latest actions add fuel to that fire?
Yeah, I mean, this was something that was already about to boil over. I mean, if you think about the lead up to the election, the incredible backlash that Twitter and Facebook got for how they handled the New York Post story about Hunter Biden in the weeks before the election really angered a lot of people on the right. And this is just feeding that narrative even more. You know, blocking Trump was sort of the ultimate weapon that Twitter had, and they've now done that. And, you know, it's really unclear where we go from here, but there's a lot of anger, certainly, and feeling that Twitter did this for reasons of political bias. And, you know, Twitter obviously strongly pushes back on that and says we treat everyone the same. And what we see, you know, is incitement of violence. And that's why we're acting.
And I want to talk more about how this fits into questions that lawmakers are already asking about these tech companies. Some lawmakers are in the process of reviewing Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which gives these platforms a liability shield for how they moderate content. How could these latest actions impact that process?
Well, big tech was already going to be under scrutiny in this Congress, and this just makes that, you know, all the more certain. And really, I think is going to motivate Republicans to look at this and potentially, you know, we'll have to see, but potentially join with Democrats to adopt some legislation targeting big tech. You know, for example, we saw on Friday, after Twitter's action against President Trump, Senator Lindsey Graham, who's, you know, the top Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, kind of moved beyond a position that he had taken before. He had talked about we should change Section 230. Now he's with Trump and saying get rid of it. So, you know, that's a small thing, but it just shows that the events of the last week really have kind of paved the way potentially for legislation on this. And, you know, passing legislation is always really hard, and Congress is going to have a lot to do. And that doesn't mean that something's definitely going to happen, but it does make it more likely.
So Parler also is accusing these companies of coordinating to squelch a competitor. And that's something that both Democrats and Republicans have been looking into. They've both had concerns about big tech's market power. Google and Facebook are being sued on antitrust grounds, and other companies are being investigated as well. Part of the charges in some of the antitrust suits include concerns that some of these companies may have collaborated in order to maintain their position in the market. How do you think these latest events will play into ongoing and future antitrust investigations?
Well, it's not clear yet whether there will be an antitrust investigation of what the companies did to Parler. Parler has filed its suit, and so it will be able to pursue those claims on its own, even if the federal government doesn't get involved. But I think you do have to, I mean, even if you're not a government official, you sort of take a step back and look at this and think, wow, you know, here was a company going along, actually getting a lot of downloads, and in a matter of a few days has basically been totally shut down. That is a lot of power that's held by a few companies, you know? And so I think lawmakers are having that reaction too. And whether that shakes out into specific legislation isn't clear yet. I talked over the weekend with one Republican congressman, Ken Buck from Colorado. He said he thinks Republicans really need to start being more open to the idea that there ought to be more antitrust enforcement against big tech companies, because in his view, if you're a conservative and you're concerned about censorship or free speech, what you need to do is look at the market power that these companies have. Now, there are lots of Republicans that may be skeptical of that because traditionally they've not wanted the government to get involved in the marketplace as much as Democrats have. But, you know, maybe there's some more room for compromise there. Maybe this whole situation motivates members of Congress to legislate more on antitrust. And there are going to be those efforts, and they have even more momentum now. And one other thing we should note, by the way, is Democrats are now in control of the Senate. And so that just makes it easier to pass legislation when you have one party in control of both the House and the Senate.
And of course, we should say here that the companies have denied those allegations of anti-competitive behavior, and they say they operate in very competitive marketplaces. You know, Ryan, we've talked a lot about how Republicans are responding. What do Democrats say to all this?
Well, on the one hand, Democrats are very pleased that the social media companies have become more aggressive. You know, there were a lot of them that wanted Twitter to permanently ban President Trump many, many months, even years ago. And so they're happy about that. On the other hand, they're also saying, why did this take so long? Why did it have to get to the point where there was a riot at the Capitol for you to take this step? And that means that Democrats are still wondering, still actively working on the idea that there ought to be more regulation of these companies. You know, if anything, it has reinforced that notion for a lot of them because they think this got way too far and the government should have been more proactive.
And it seems like this moment has brought these two previously disparate complaints against big tech a bit closer together. That's the Section 230 complaints and the antitrust concerns. Could that complicate the path forward for these companies?
Well, it complicates it in the sense that, you know, it's harder to fight all these different battles at once. But on the other hand, you know, it could cut the other way, right? If Congress isn't particularly focused on one issue or the other, and they're kind of all over the place, maybe that makes it less likely that anything gets done at all. So we'll have to see whether these efforts actually get momentum. And one of the points that we make in a story that we published early this week is that some debates about tech regulation are more advanced than others. So in the case of privacy, for example, lawmakers have coalesced around a couple of bills that would put consumer data privacy protections in place and would affect the companies. That legislation looks more ready to move than, say, Section 230, where lawmakers are actually kind of all over the place. There are a lot of different proposals out there. Joe Biden has said that he wants to revoke the law, but he hasn't really said what he would replace it with and what exactly that would look like. And so there's kind of the process with Section 230 is not as advanced. And so, you know, that would lead one to believe, well, maybe privacy legislation or even antitrust legislation will move more quickly than Section 230. You know, but that could be wrong. We'll have to see what happens once the Congress gets rolling. And frankly, once it deals with all these other things it has to deal with, like impeachment and COVID and all these other issues that are going to be way ahead of tech regulation in terms of, you know, priority.
Yeah, they've got a lot on their plate right from the start there. So taking a step back here, All of these companies are arguing that they had to take the measures that they did because people are using their platforms to incite violence. And this feels like a moment in which we might get some answers about whose responsibility it actually is to address that, the tech companies or the regulators.
Yeah, you know, I think what this really brings up is we still haven't, as a country, really figured out what the rules of the road are for the internet, right? You know, what is the standard by which someone can be blocked on a social media site? Well, there are lots of different answers to that. Twitter has one answer. Facebook has another answer. YouTube has another answer. There are no standards about this. We're kind of making it up as we go along, in a sense. And the government, you know, certainly has a role, and we've seen tech executives sometimes ask the government, please help us with this. Tell us what to do. Give us some North Star. And Congress really hasn't done that. And so you're seeing the companies have to make these decisions on their own. And, you know, I think with the events of the past week where, in the view of the companies and many others, democracy was really at stake, that kind of changed the game and made them go to a place they had never gone before. You know, so now we're in this new world where the sitting president of the United States has been blocked. You know, it's never been clear that we need some standards. We need to know, like, when that should happen, when it's okay for that to happen and when it isn't. You know, so that's the kind of issues that Congress is going to be grappling with. And, you know, absent Congress doing anything, it effectively continues to be the company's decision.
All right. That's our reporter, Ryan Tracy. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. Take care.
The Watcher. The Watcher. The Watcher. The Watcher. The Watcher. The Watcher. The Watcher.
I was locked up for no reason, Najir Parks told the New York Times last month. Parks was recounting his arrest for allegedly shoplifting from a New Jersey Hampton Inn gift shop, giving officers a false ID, and then making a run for it in a rental car. Except that Parks had proof that he was 30 miles away when all of that happened. But police were convinced they had the right man. They used facial recognition to match Najir Parks' face to that of the black man pictured on the phony ID. Parks' story backs up activist concerns about the critical flaws of artificial intelligence, specifically facial recognition. Studies have confirmed that facial recognition routinely misidentifies women, and especially people of color. Which is why I'm alarmed that Governor Charlie Baker insisted that it be included in the recently passed police reform bill. State lawmakers passed the bipartisan bill after months of intense negotiation and deliberately excluded facial recognition. But Governor Baker made it clear he would only sign the bill with a facial recognition amendment. Despite widespread vocal opposition from black and brown lawmakers, the ACLU, and members of the Celtics basketball team. Police unions in Massachusetts lobbied for facial recognition to be included, claiming the methodology has been successful in identifying criminals. And that is true in some cases. But what is also true is that this technology has a dangerous bias. As the National Institute of Standards and Technology reported, recognition technology misidentifies Asian and African American faces 10 to 100 times more than white faces, even more for Native American faces. In a test sample, 28 congressional members, mostly people of color, including the late civil rights icon John Lewis, were positively and erroneously identified with mugshots from a law enforcement database. No one understands the limitations of this flawed technology more than MIT's Joy Boulamwini, the founder of the Algorithmic Justice League and a top expert in artificial intelligence. Dr. Boulamwini has used her extensive research documenting the inherent bias in AI to persuade corporations like Microsoft, Amazon, and IBM not to sell facial recognition technology to police departments. And last year, I highlighted the four Massachusetts cities, including Cambridge, which banned facial recognition's use. Clearly, the amendment included in the law goes against the tide of ever-widening acceptance that facial recognition in its current form can be harmful. Given its potential for harm, the now police-sanctioned use of the technology stands to undermine the other positive measures in the police reform law. One of the reasons State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz called the compromises in the legislation heartbreaking. The police reform law is absolutely a significant step toward addressing the concerns of citizens who've often suffered at the hands of violent police officers with little recourse. But Najir Park's story is a sharp reminder of what's at stake with facial recognition. The 33-year-old, who was jailed before his case was finally dismissed, notes how scary the misidentification was, saying, "I just never thought it would happen to me." Callie Crossley, GBH, Boston's local NPR.
Common knowledge that the FBI has a database of people's fingerprints. Many local police have their databases too, and so it turns out, does the United States military. American forces have been gathering biometric data on the people they encounter in war zones for years. It's a way to tell the good guys from the bad, though the investigative reporter Annie Jacobson argues it doesn't always work. In a book called First Platoon, Jacobson follows the lives of Americans told to gather that data in Afghanistan, and she questions what the U.S. government means to do with it all.
The Defense Department comes up with this idea that the only way to win the war on terror is through biometrics, through the tagging, tracking, and locating of individual people. And there began the birth of this system, which is now a Defense Department system called the Automated Biometrics Identification System, known as ABIS.
Let's talk about which biometrics we mean here. Fingerprints, obviously, but what else?
Then you have iris scans, facial images, and ultimately DNA that are now all being used by the Defense Department to create catalogs of people all around the world and also in the United States who can then be linked to a crime.
How did the Pentagon build up and then apply this database in Afghanistan?
It began originally in Iraq with a bunch of FBI agents who I interview for the book, helping out the Defense Department, figuring out who the bomb makers were. It was this idea that, you know, until you go after the bomb makers, you're just going to have this ongoing war. And so FBI agents were teaching Defense Department employees how to pull fingerprints off of bomb parts. And then the Defense Department decided, well, we don't really want FBI agents muddling around in our business. We're going to take over this program ourselves. And that's when things get very complicated in Afghanistan, starting around 2010, when the Defense Department decided to create what was called rule of law in Afghanistan.
Meaning that the Defense Department, which was fighting a war in Afghanistan, was going to approach the conflict not as a conflict involving armed groups, although it obviously was that, but as a law enforcement effort where they would go after specific suspects in society using these biometrics. Is that right?
Absolutely. And they created this sprawling billion-dollar system based on the fundamental of an American criminal justice system, which very simply has three components: law enforcement, courts, and corrections. So cops, judicial system, and then prisons, or in the case of Afghanistan, detainees. And so this is where First Platoon comes in, because unbeknownst to them, they were essentially acting like cops on a beat. And so were countless platoons across Afghanistan, young soldiers who are now patrolling villages, carrying small biometric collection devices to create a giant catalog, which would then be used as the database to compare criminal fingerprints pulled off bombs from.
How much of the population of Afghanistan is in the database now?
The original goal by the Defense Department was to capture biometrics on 80% of the population of Afghanistan. Approximately 25 million people was the goal.
Did they reach it?
It's unknown, because these statistics are jealously guarded by the Defense Department, and they're not available from the government of Afghanistan.
Well, however many millions of people they have ended up with in the database, do military officials contend that this database has helped them fight the war?
It depends who you ask. If you ask someone at the FBI, they would likely tell you no. The Defense Department officials that I interviewed, mostly those who were involved in setting up this system, concede how many mistakes were made. You know, I think when we look at a worst case scenario, maybe look at a place like China. China is often criticized for this program that they now have going on called Physicals for All. And it's, in essence, a program to capture biometrics on all of the Uyghurs who live in China. So they have, you know, a program to tag, track, and locate and detain Uyghurs. Well, this is widely criticized among human rights organizations around the world, and yet, in essence, they took a page out of the playbook of the U.S. Defense Department.
What's the ultimate danger here?
I think, one, these biometric big data surveillance systems and databases are dividing people into us and them. You know, overseas we saw it with civilian and insurgent. Here in the United States, we see it with law-abiding citizen and potential threat. I think that dividing people in this manner opens up the door for more division, more polemics, and ultimately more fighting between different groups of people instead of everybody working together for this common idea that rule of law is actually a great thing for a democratic society.
Annie Jacobson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
This the city of Chicago.
Some Chicagoans traveled to Washington, D.C. this week. They bum-rushed the Capitol to challenge the certification of the results from the fair U.S. Democratic presidential election in November. They falsely believe President Donald Trump won. Now, other Chicagoans are outing those insurgents on social media to hold them accountable for their actions. WBEZ's Maria Inez Zamudio reports.
Josephine Janosak-Liszczynski watched in horror what she described as a failed coup d'etat. She couldn't sleep that night after watching violent white riders storm the Capitol. Some carried Confederate flags or wore symbols of white supremacy.
I woke up the next morning and I went actually on Facebook, and there were these like neighborhood groups that I'm a part of, and people were posting call out.
The 30-year-old decided she would help by identifying insurgents from Chicago. This is a similar tactic anti-racist used to identify white supremacists who marched in Charlottesville, Virginia back in 2017. So she got to work. The Albany Park resident quickly found videos and photos. She was particularly upset about one post from a Chicago woman.
Libby Andrews, the real estate agent's caption comes to mind about her glass of champagne after storming the Capitol. Like, that is very clear language about how they viewed this.
Andrews posted a video where she eagerly explained what happened on Wednesday.
Hey, everyone. So I was just at the Capitol, and I stormed the Capitol, and I made it to the top. And I have pictures which I'll post on top and everywhere, and great videos and everything. And actually, it was a lot of fun.
The 53-year-old can be seen in photos, smiling in the crowds and talking to others during a Facebook Live. Janosak-Liszczynski outed Andrews. Ad Properties fired her. Even if people like Andrews didn't violently ransack the Capitol, activists say the event was not a political rally. It was an effort planned for months to stop Joe Biden from being president. These Trump mobs carried guns. They broke the law. They incited violence. So far, few have been arrested. One CEO from a northwest Chicago suburb now faces federal charges. He's been fired. The activist wasn't behind outing him, but she says business owners should be held accountable.
Someone who's deciding to own a business and run a business, you have a responsibility to support the people who you're paying.
Janosak-Liszczynski has outed other Chicagoans, including several tattoo artists from Inside Tattoo in Chicago's Wicker Park neighborhood, who posted photos from outside the Capitol. The owner of Chicago's best barbershop in Logan Square posted photos and videos. When I called him, he hung up on me.
And two Tank Noodle owners joined efforts to overturn the election in Trump's favor.
I didn't expect it to blow up. Like, within 15 minutes, it was just, like, basically going viral.
Since then, Yanisak Liszczynski says she's gotten death threats.
I'm scared. I'd rather I have a target in my back than someone else, honestly. I'm in a better position. I'm privileged. I'm much more privileged to be in a safe position. When, like, I was afraid to be in my apartment, I had somewhere else to go. So I'm grateful for that.
She says she's taking a break this weekend, but she'll continue to out insurgents next week. Marina Zamudio, WBEZ News.
Hello, sir. I'm Officer Calloway. I'm here to...
I didn't see nothing. I don't know nothing.
Right.
Cheers.
Granddad really didn't know anything about the break-ins, but his unwillingness to talk with the police is a common trait with black people.
Federal investigators say they expect hundreds of criminal cases to be filed after last week's deadly riot at the Capitol. The people who took part in that pro-Trump march and the violence that followed also face a fierce backlash from the public. Some have lost jobs, others face condemnation in their communities. A few have even received death threats. NPR's Brian Mann has been looking into this and joins us now. And first, Brian, we've been hearing details about some of the individuals, but give us a better sense of the people who took part in this riot.
Yeah, it was a really wide range of pro-Trump supporters, Tanya. Some clearly fully radicalized militia groups, white supremacists. Those people came with firearms. One man brought Molotov cocktails. Others brought the kind of zip ties you use to handcuff people. There's video of rioters, of course, assaulting police officers. Really brutal and frightening. And the DOJ says those are the individuals who will face the most serious criminal charges. But we've also learned people were there who broke into the Capitol came from all kinds of backgrounds. NPR has identified business executives, an attorney, a stay-at-home mom, a local public official. Yeah. Many of them were making really militant remarks as they marched toward the Capitol. Jenna Ryan is a Trump supporter who sells real estate in Texas. This is from a live stream she posted that day on Facebook.
And you know what? If it comes down to war, guess what? I'm going to be there. Yep, I'll be fighting on the front lines because I'm that kind of girl.
And Ryan later posted a photo of herself on Twitter next to a smashed window at the Capitol. I should say Ryan didn't respond to NPR's efforts to ask her questions. In fact, a lot of folks we tried to contact didn't respond. Others told us they wouldn't talk. And many of them, Tanya, have been busy scrubbing their social media feeds since last Wednesday, deleting Twitter and Facebook accounts.
Okay, scrubbing their social media feeds, is that likely to work? I mean, can these people just go home, delete what happened that day, and put it behind them?
Yeah, not going to happen, says the FBI. A lot of these folks left clear digital trails showing what they were up to that day. And in response, many members of the public have been working together to identify rioters from clues on social media. Steve D'Antuono, head of the FBI's Washington, D.C. field office, talked to reporters about this yesterday.
We have received more than 100,000 pieces of digital media, which is absolutely fantastic. And we are scouring every one for investigative and intelligence leads.
And with that much evidence out there, the Justice Department is encouraging people who were there at the Capitol that day to go ahead and turn themselves in. And some people have been doing just that.
Mm. As I mentioned, some rioters have already faced some personal consequences for these actions. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, some of it's pretty intense. The town of Troy, New Hampshire, had to shut its government offices after the local police chief who was at the Trump rally started getting death threats. He says he didn't take part in the violence that day. Other people who were at the Capitol have lost their jobs. Brad Rextalis, who was president and CEO of a tech company in the Chicago area, his company has confirmed in a statement that he was fired after being arrested. Rextalis put out a statement acknowledging he joined the pro-Trump crowd who went into the building. He called it, quote, the single worst personal decision of my life. Other companies in Maryland and Texas have confirmed they, too, fired employees who entered the Capitol that day.
Brian, so many people were there that day. I mean, a lot of people have this question. How does the FBI decide where to focus its resources and who's most dangerous?
Yeah, it's a really big challenge, Tanya, again, because so many people who were there that day were making such threatening and violent remarks. Again, here's the FBI's Steve D'Antuono.
Which of the individuals saying despicable things on the internet are just practicing keyboard bravado, or they actually have the intent to do harm?
So the FBI is working to sort that out. But what is clear is that many Trump supporters crossed a very serious line when they breached the Capitol's defenses and could face very serious costs going forward.
NPR's Brian Mann.
Thank you.
So, you know, these events that keep coming up, instead of just reacting, dealing with it one at a time and being shocked each time we have another event that surfaces that is brought to our attention, we need to function from the position of an analysis that clarifies we are in a total system structure of racism, white supremacy, and that is why we are seeing the kinds of behaviors from individuals, be it Donald Sterling or be it George Zimmerman or any of the other cases that come to our attention. There is a reason that these cases exist. And I want to also talk about, in this case, they talked about mental health, but also gun control. And we have to begin to understand, I say you can't understand the gun mania if you don't understand racism, white supremacy. The gun is the answer to conscious and or subconscious, the answer, the response to the white collective feeling they can be genetically annihilated by black genetic material. And the gun is a great equalizer. I encourage everybody to get a copy of the ISIS papers and read.
Local officials and law enforcement are preparing for what could be a violent week at state capitals across the country. There have been warnings from the FBI and others after a mob smashed their way into the U.S. Capitol last week. They've said that armed right-wing extremists could potentially try something similar in states ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. Three of the states where authorities have sounded the alarm loudly are Oregon, Michigan, and Virginia. So we're joined by reporters in each of those places to talk about what may be ahead. Dirk Vanderhart joins us from Oregon Public Broadcasting. Abigail Sinsky joins us from member station WKAR in Lansing, Michigan. And Whitney Evans joins us from member station VPM in Richmond, Virginia. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, let's start with you, Whitney. What are officials in Virginia looking out for there?
Yeah, again, I'm in the state capitol here in Richmond, and it's been difficult to get a sense of what sources in these online forums are saying is planned in Virginia and who's expected to show up in the coming days. The information we've seen is really kind of conflicting, and many of these fringe groups, as you know, have been kicked off of social media platforms. But there are already expected to be large crowds because of a pro-gun rally scheduled for Monday. It actually happens every year and generally without incident, but it tends to draw some people from right-wing extremist groups. Members of the far-right and anti-government groups like Proud Boys have attended that rally in the past.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and this is Dirk in Oregon. You know, we haven't heard many details either about what the demonstrations might look like, but far-right demonstrators have gathered repeatedly at the state capitol in Salem in recent weeks. The most serious incident took place on December 21st when a crowd showed up to demand entry into the capitol, which has been closed. And at one point, a Republican lawmaker appears to have purposely allowed those demonstrators in via a side door, which set off a physical clash between state police and protesters. At one point, officers were maced, folks were assaulted. And just more generally, I would say this is part of the country that has seen its share of anti-government extremism, and people see that thread continuing in recent events.
Mm-hmm. We definitely saw so much of that as well over the summer. Abigail, Michigan has been at the center as well of several politically charged protests. What are the concerns ahead of Biden's inauguration there?
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier this year, armed men stood over state lawmakers in the state Senate chamber. And of course, there was an alleged plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. So there's a lot of concern going into this weekend and next week. This week, our Capitol Commission did ban long guns from the building, but our Attorney General, Dana Nessel, has not been shy about saying that doesn't make the building secure at all. This is what she said on CNN earlier this week.
We don't have anybody to even check if you do have a license. We have no metal detectors. So if you were to bring an explosive device into the Capitol, if you were to bring multiple weapons, as long as they're underneath a coat or a jacket or in a bag, no one would ever know about it.
Like the AG said there, security is light, especially during session, and lawmakers are scheduled to meet 3 days next week.
Okay, so I want to ask all of you this question. What kind of security changes with all of this in light are happening to keep people safe? Dirk, how are authorities there preparing?
Well, you know, it's notable to hear Abigail talk about Michigan's Capitol because there's a very similar story here. Since protesters got into the state house in December, state leaders have been taking safety extremely seriously. On Wednesday, the governor activated the National Guard in order to secure the Capitol from potential protests. Then just yesterday, we learned that the legislature is going to effectively postpone the start of the legislative session. They had been expected to meet Tuesday. Now they're going to push back hearings until after the inauguration. And, you know, I mentioned earlier a Republican who had let demonstrators into the Capitol. There has been swift discipline in that case. He could face expulsion in the legislature and potential criminal charges.
Oh, wow. Abigail, what about there in Michigan?
Well, a 6-foot fence is being put up around the Capitol building today. We've already seen an increased police presence, and that will stick around for the next couple of weeks. Officials have said there's been constant coordination with the National Guard, local and state police. But a lot of this planning has also been happening off of mainstream social media. So there are federal and local law enforcement that are kind of tracking that chatter, but they have not said anything about credible threats of violence.
Whitney Evans here in Richmond. Compared to Michigan and Oregon, Virginia's state government buildings and Capitol building are actually pretty secure, to the point that it's often a pain as a reporter to move in and out, and it's only gotten tighter over the last year. They already use metal detectors for entry into buildings, and most of the doors stay locked. Aside from that, they're putting up barricades and closing roads around the Capitol. Also interesting to note that those buildings will be mostly empty because lawmakers are meeting virtually and at another location because of COVID. Governor Ralph Northam said Thursday that the state is prepared and won't tolerate violence or mutiny.
If you're planning to come here or up to Washington with ill intent in your heart, you need to turn around right now and go home.
And again, Governor Northam, he said, in terms of police presence, local and state law enforcement have a unified presence here in the city, along with the National Guard.
Okay, a unified presence in the city of Richmond. This is important because, you know, I'm actually familiar with Lansing, Michigan, Abigail. State capitals are also where people live. I'm thinking about other parts of the city. Have authorities at any of the places where you all are talked about citywide plans to keep people safe? Abigail.
Yeah, so I talked to a city council president who's been in frequent conversation with our chief of police, and he said he's confident that the city will stay safe and that the peace will be kept this weekend. The thinking behind planning is that they don't want to wake up Monday morning and say, we could have done more.
Mm-hmm. Dirk.
Yeah, you know, the focal point really has been the Capitol in the recent demonstrations we've seen. I think to the extent people have citywide concerns, that has more been focused on Portland, where obviously there has been a lot of unrest in the last year, and that will continue as well in coming days.
We're talking with Dirk Vanderhart from Oregon Public Broadcasting, Abigail Sinsky with member station WKAR in Michigan, and Whitney Evans with member station VPM in Virginia about safety at state capitals ahead of next week's inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. Thanks to you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully, to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 16, 2021. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, suggestions to share. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720 716-7300, decode 564-943, pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. All of that said, man, so the counter-racist grind continues. We have been on every day this week except for Monday. We were here Tuesday. We had Patrick J. McKenna continuing with our O.J. Simpson studies. We have the book club and all that, but the investigator for Mr. Simpson who found the Furman tapes was with us Tuesday. Wednesday, we had Muhammad Abdul-Rahim. First time we've had a non-white guest on the program in, I don't know, it's been a long time, almost 6 months. I said we would have every once in a while, but it was not going to be a common thing. White guests only. But we did have Muhammad Abdul-Rahim. He was with us Wednesday. We talked about Miriam Carey's 2013 murder and contrasted the lethal force used by Capitol Police and U.S. Secret Service as opposed to what we saw last week. White treasonous terrorists. Thursday, we had the book club, started the O.J. Simpson criminal trial. Fascinating study session. I'm so excited. Looking forward for next Thursday already. Neutralizing workplace racism yesterday. Obviously, we're here today. Tomorrow, we will be here for the Global Sunday Talk on Racism. I'm eager to speak with non-white people in different parts of the world tomorrow afternoon, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. Certainly, we will eagerly await their thoughts on the terrorist activity in the Capitol last week, see how that was reported in different parts of the world, how things have been discussed subsequently over there, and then also to talk about the Rona situation. They instituted new, stricter lockdown measures in different parts of Europe, check on the vaccine, just lots of things happening in the world, the whole Brexit situation, lots to check on. So that'll be tomorrow, non-white victims of white supremacy, Global Sunday Talk. And then we'll be here on Monday, Dotsy Bosk. She is an Olympic athlete and is a vegan, practicing vegan, does a lot of talks about the importance of nutrition, taking care of yourself, non-dairy diet options, and even tying that to racism with how non-white people, black people in particular, are often restricted. They make it really difficult for us to get quality foods, and the dairy component, where they will stuff all kinds of dairy this and milk that on cheese this on black people, non-white people, and a lot of us are lactose intolerant, don't even have the ability to properly digest all of those fatty, unhealthful, toxic foods. So that'll be Monday, and white woman, so we'll be back to white guests. But staying on the counter-racist grind, and we might even have Alan Dershowitz. O.J. Simpson. Now, I inquired about speaking to him because we're doing our O.J. Simpson. He was on the O.J. Simpson defense team. However, we started this whole study session on Jeffrey Toobin's work, not because Gus T. Renegade wanted to cape for O.J. Simpson, but because Jeffrey Toobin, Zoom bomber of 2020, that's why we started reading Run of His Life. And so Adam Dershowitz, ooh-wee, the Jeffrey Epstein case, that is also something that people all over the world have been discussing. So he is involved. He was one of Mr. Epstein's homies and legal counsel. And he was also accused by one of these young women, young white women, that, you know, he was engaged in all of this underage sexual intercourse and all the rest of it. So lots to chat about. And I think he was even defending President Trump's impeachment. Lots to chat about there. But I mean, yeah, that was the impetus, was O.J. Simpson. He was right there on the defense team. So we might even have Alan Dershowitz. We will have an exemplary O.J. Simpson catalog with the book club and then all of the subsequent guests. Listen, check out the archives. All right, next. In all of the hubbub about what happened at the Capitol, I saw a report here in Washington State where they had a number of Seattle enforcement officers who are accused of having been a part of the fracas. Now, Seattle, Washington is about 3,000 miles from Washington, D.C. I was there this summer. Like, it is no, that is not a short trip. Like, that's one you have to plan a little bit. I think I had a direct flight from Seattle to Washington. I think I left at approximately 8 a.m. this summer for the retreat, touchdown in Washington. I think it was about 4 o'clock, something in that area. So it is, you know, this is not a, oh, hey, I think I'd like to hang out in D.C. for a little while. Like, no, like this has to be well thought out in advance. I've planned it, got it together. Like, yeah, not some, oh, I just think I'm going to wake up and head out to Washington, D.C. for a whole afternoon lunch. Like 3,000 miles to go and engage in total barbarism and savagery. Like, are you serious? So then I saw that article first that they had Seattle enforcement officers who engaged in all of this, you know, ridiculousness, excuse me, terrorism. And then I saw that it was widespread. It wasn't just, you know, oh man, it's just these one or two enforcement officials in Seattle that they got. Let me just get the report here, that it's widespread, that there are large numbers of enforcement officers and military personnel who are accused of having participated in all of this. So I'll pull up. They had a number of reports. I'm just going to see if I can grab the NPR report really quick. Off-duty police officers investigated charged with participating in Capitol riot. Nearly 30 sworn police officers from a dozen departments attended the pro-Trump rally at the U.S. Capitol last week, and several stormed the building with rioters and are facing federal criminal charges as well as possible expulsion or other discipline. The officers are from departments large and small. There was veteran officer in Houston, the nation's eighth largest department, the sergeant in the small town of Rocky Mountain, Virginia, the Coon Man, and a group of Philadelphia transit officers. Five people were killed in the riots, including Capitol Officer Brian Sicknick and Trump supporter Ashley Babbitt, who was shot by an officer when she attempted to breach a barricaded door inside the Capitol. Houston police officer Tam Phan, an 18-year veteran, resigned Thursday in wake of federal charges against him. Houston Chief Art Agveto said in a tweet, photos emerged showing Phan inside the Capitol during the riots holding a Trump flag alongside other pro-Trump extremists. Federal prosecutors are investigating. Now, I think, or I would hope, that gives a whole new, well, wait a minute, let's see. In Virginia, photos emerged showing Rocky Mountain Police Sergeant, Police Sergeant T.J. Robertson and Officer Jacob Fracker inside the Capitol with other rioters. Robertson told the Roanoke Times that he and Officer Fracker did nothing illegal. What are you doing in the Capitol? Where I was at, there was no violence. There was no fighting with police officers. Federal prosecutors say otherwise. Whole new thought to the concept of race soldier. Now, again, this isn't even one of the better reports where they talked about it wasn't just enforcement officers. It was enforcement officers and military personnel. And they even had some photographs that seemed to show individuals who would be classified as white with paraphernalia, gear, clothing, attire that would seem to suggest some sort of connection to military personnel. Now, again, they have all kinds of army surplus stores and all the rest, and it's very popular to go and get that gear, even if you haven't served. So that could certainly be the case, but it would not surprise me at all if you have got a substantial number of individuals classified as white. They've had all of those reports for so many years. I mean, what would be surprising about that? They've had so many reports about the problem of white supremacists infiltrating the military, law enforcement, to gain expertise with explosives, firearms for their militant activities. That's been all the way back to 2009 when President Obama was first elected. So nothing strikes me as unbelievable or strange about that That's what I would expect within a system of white supremacy. Just make sure that component is added to all of the madness for the coming week. Next, the report from PBS, there were a number. They had the report where they were talking about the so-called long haulers. These are people who are diagnosed with COVID-19 and then they end up having some sort of long-term problems, some sort of issue. They were talking about respiratory issues, circulatory issues, things of that nature happening to people even once they have, you know, they're no longer testing positive for COVID-19. Within that report, they talked to a number of different folks. Some of them, or number one, this is audio. They didn't have video with this. They have some pictures with the report, but I was listening to the audio, so they don't have video. Can't see everybody. They talked to a female who seemed to identify that she was Black, Shimmeri Smith, Chimere. And she talked about some of the difficulties that she was having before. And then she got to the end. There were a few parts, but she got to the end of it. And she said that she's gone through all these tests and she had times where doctors were telling her that it's all in her head, that you're making up these symptoms. And there's nothing wrong with you, that you're intimidating. And we heard that before. I remember we talked about the Black female doctor, I think Dr. Sarah Jones, where she recently passed away. And she had made the video saying that she was getting racist treatment while she was in the hospital. And then they responded after she died. The white hospital officials responded and said, we found her to be intimidating. Remember that one? So they talked to Shimmeri Smith in this PBS report we heard today, and she gave some of the same reports. And then she got a little bit further down and she said, I don't want another Black woman to go into a hospital with these symptoms that go on and on and on and seem so never ending and to be told that she's too smart to know about her own body or that she's too aggressive to take action on what happens to her health. I don't want that for anybody else. And then she continues. Let's see. So Stephanie Tsai, she's doing the interviewing. Shimmeri's persistence to find answers is paying off. A new diet. I put a highlight right there. A new diet. Now, they didn't give more details about what she was eating before and how things have changed. But man, oh man, Dr. Ruby Lathan, I spoke with her over this past weekend. Diet, eating correctly, is so critical to health. I'm sure there are, you know, some other changes that she could make or what have you, but drinking your water, getting away from that dairy, that's what we'll be talking about Monday, getting away from all that dairy and what have you, more fresh fruits, vegetables, get your legumes, your beans, leave that processed food alone. You will be doing much better. I don't know if that's, you know, what Shimmeri Smith did, but I would hope so. They said she got a new diet and medication regimen is making her feel a little better. Shimmeri Smith, one on my darkest days in the dark. Now, that's one I hadn't even heard before. Look how they did this. This is the program for no metaphors, right? They said, on my darkest days in the dark, no light in my room at all when I couldn't even really see anything. I could not imagine a future for myself, and now I actually can, and I'm happy about that. Well, this, and it goes back, Stephanie Tsai, interviewer. Well, this is a cliche too, but it sounds like it made you stronger. And then Shimmeri Smith, girl, and then laughter. Don't have me crying over here. Yes, absolutely. Now, she's a victim of white supremacy, Shimmeri Smith. She's guaranteed, you know, whatever stance that she takes. And I mean, hey, if it seems like your health is getting back together, we can take care of yourself, other folks that you care about and what have you. That is something to be happy about. All of that said, I have said for years, I think all the way back to when we read Medical Apartheid. And in fact, Renelia Randall, Dying While Black, when she was on the program in 2009, both of them said this sort of nonsense, this cliche, it sounds like this has made you stronger. That is absurd. That's not even a good enough word for it. That is malarkey of the highest order. That's not a good enough word for it. Racism, white supremacy, really. Having a white person tell you, oh my goodness, slavery just made you all so strong. You getting the Rona just made you so strong. You being in Flint and having to go through an obstacle course to get a 16-ounce bottle of water has just made you so strong. They didn't go say that to the white rioters and say, well, this whole experience, if you lost your job, got transferred, might be federally prosecuted, has it made you stronger? They didn't say that. They only say that nonsense to black people, where something that could kill you, oh, it's made you so strong. We got this strong black woman, this strong black man. It is absolute nonsense. And then on the darkest day, cliches. Let's see, next. Mentioned the water crisis. I don't think I can recall a compensatory call-in where I've heard the word accountable used as much as we did in the segments this week, and then much less the word accountable used to describe white people. I never hear that. It's always, we're going to hold that Al Sharpton accountable. We're going to hold that Benjamin Crump account. We're going to hold that Jesse Jackson account. We're going to hold that no count coon Obama account. I never hear we're going to hold a white person accountable. Of course, I don't know how a victim of white supremacy would hold a white person accountable, whatever that means, in the system. But I did find it fascinating. We will have to see. I seriously doubt if they mean some of the white people who are responsible for the chemical and biological warfare that took place in Flint, Michigan. If they mean, will some of these folks be criminally prosecuted? No, I don't think that's going to happen. We'll have to wait and see. I could be totally in error, but I don't think that's going to happen. If they mean seriously prosecuting the folks who went to Washington, D.C. last week, if they mean prosecuting these folks as treasonous traitors and terrorists, domestic, if I start seeing some charges for domestic terrorism, then maybe I would consider, wow, we got accountability in 2021. Like, yes, I will be all for using the word accountability, but until then, no. And certainly not for holding other black people accountable. That's next. We are listener supported Counter Racist Radio. It will be a dozen years next month. Not really sure how to feel about that either way. Either we've been more or less constructive for 12 years, or we have wasted time and contributed to the problem. Certainly make sure you are not just the listening, because you've been listening for, you know, a few weeks or a few months or a few years or whatever it is. With everything that is happening in the world, crises on top of crises, we, victims of white supremacy, do not have time to waste. If you are tuning in to the Context of White Supremacy live or archives, make sure you are getting constructive information on what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what we can be doing to solve this problem immediately. Listener-supported Counter-Racist Radio. You can hit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, my review for Isabel Wilkerson's case is the most recent post. We read that in the book club, second worst book ever. You can check that out. And or invest. PayPal button is at the top right corner. Also on Cash App, cash.app/$thecows. Much obliged to all the folks who have supported and kept us on the air for those dozen years. I hope we have helped some folks, helped victims get a better understanding of what the system is, how it works. We're also on Amazon, the wish list, Gus T. Renegade. Much obliged to all the folks who have nabbed items over the years. Super, super appreciated. Let's see. Next. This was also on PBS, the report where they talked about the education disparities as a result of the Rona shutting down schools and things having to be virtual. We just had, I do not have offspring. We just had a number of parents on Neutralizing Workplace Racism yesterday evening who talked about, hey, I have offspring and I see how this is impacting black children in so many different components. Even if you have a young scholar, we have a number of them, our young fellow out in New England, but even if you have a young scholar, hey, being away from school, it's so much more than just, oh, okay, we're going to come in and do a little calculus. Oh, okay, we'll do a little physics. It's so much more than that. And missing out on that and being all isolated and stuck where you have to be in front of a screen for an indeterminate amount of time. We had a number of folks who were parents who were talking about the impact that they've seen with their children and how they're making an effort to check in on their mental health and just doing things to talk to them, try to encourage them, activities to get them up and away from that computer screen, get outside. Had to sneeze, excuse me. But doing things to get them up, get them outside, get them moving, that sort of thing, get some socializing going on. All of that is super important. If you think you, as an older person, have been stressed, impacted by everything revolving the Rona, do not think for an instant that all of that stress and strife has missed your offspring or younger black people that you are around. So really make sure, to the degree that you can, invest some time checking in on them, seeing how they are doing. Ask and show them a little extra care if possible. This has been rough on everyone. Let's see. Next, the whole bit on, we had so many different components about technology, the use of technology to ban some of the rioters, the use of technology to go after some of the rioters, the use of technology to make a global database of probably non-white people. It was so many different components to the technology. I would just think that as more of this advances, it is all going to be used to strengthen this system. I'm very sure, since they say they got so many bias problems with their facial recognition, since it was white terrorists out in D.C., that means it should be perfect, right? You should have no problem. Get the video footage and just get cracking. Oh, bam, that's Betty Sue, and bam, 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 and just get to identifying and prosecuting. That's all you have to do, right? That word accountable again. We'll see what happens. Incidentally, I did see a number of reports. Shout to Pamela Evans Harris. Missed. In the interracial con game, she quotes a segment from The Cows. We had Barbara Trepanier on the program some years back, and she transcribes a portion of that interview. And she talks about how white people do not snitch. They do not rat out other white people. Hey, my brother was practicing racism, or my uncle knows more nigger jokes than you can count. Like, they don't do that sort of thing. I pointed out a few times where you do see it, like, whoa, that is an anomaly. Like, other than President Trump, you do not hear other white people. This person is a racist, and I know because I'm white. That doesn't happen. There was a little bit of that even this week. They had some white people who ratted, did exactly that. Like, oh, man, that's my uncle. That's my mom. That's my dad. They were down in D.C. and blah, blah, blah. And even that, as I don't care if they're ratting out their parents and uncles and relatives or whomever else, they are still on the racist suspect list. I think some of the folks who did some of this ratting people out might have had ulterior motives. I think one of them was a white woman. She snitched on some of her parents and other family members. She's engaged in so-called lesbianism, LGBTQ, and all the rest of it. And I think her parents or some of her so-called relatives may have had an issue with that. So I think this member, well, hey, you don't like my sexual activity, we will rat you out as being racist. Lots of different things. There's no reason any of these white people, not that this has become a whole movement, but there's no reason at all that any of these folks should be thought of as, oh my, this is the new Jane Elliott. This is the new Jane Brown, new John Brown, new Heather Hare, willing to sacrifice all in the net. Get out of here. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. This broadcast, again, no metaphors. Now, victim of racism, Shimmeri Smith. And this is why I say, like, let's be really mindful about what we say, because a lot of times if you're not really thinking about what words am I selecting to articulate my views, when we just kind of mindlessly pick these metaphors, they will support white supremacy racism. They will enforce concepts and ideas that disparage the color black and or black people and or both. On my darkest days, in the dark, no light in my room at all, when I couldn't even really see anything, I could not imagine a future for myself. That is common. Darkness, blackness, vile, evil, no future. The metaphors, this isn't even the metaphor of the week. The metaphor, when we had Patrick J. McKenna on the program on Tuesday, he said O.J. Simpson is just like George Floyd. Mark Furman tried to put his knee on O.J. Simpson's neck. I said, wow, metaphors. I'm so thankful. We have a broadcast where I talk about metaphors regularly. Now, most of my time on the planet, I have believed O.J. Simpson was guilty. So anybody, white person, non-white person, anyone using a in fact, if I had heard that metaphor in May when this Mr. Floyd was murdered, then if someone had said, oh, yeah, O.J. Simpson is just like George Floyd, I would have been appalled. Like, what are you talking about? Like, O.J. feverish O.J. Simpson is George Floyd? What? What are you talking about? Mark Furman put his knee on. I would have been furious. I would have totally considered that like disparaging George Floyd and what happened to him and how he was killed, to even compare such a person and blah, 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 and all of that. Just reading Mr. Toobin's work with the book study and getting a more accurate, detailed understanding of Mr. Simpson. Yes, it is a metaphor. It is an accurate comparison. Mr. McKenna said Mark Furman tried to put his knee on O.J. Simpson's neck. Yes, accurate. But that is why I encourage people, you should really investigate those metaphors, because it may not be, and it may be that is wrong. It might be absolutely that Gus T. is cooning. Gus T. doesn't know what he's talking about, and that is totally blasphemous and should not be compared. It's totally disparaging what happened to Mr. Floyd. If anybody, if you think that is the case, *61. But again, no metaphor, so we don't have a chance for any type of confusion. Just be direct and explicit with what we want to say. Frequently, white people, they are practicing racism. They will invoke these metaphors. And getting the Rona has just made you stronger, didn't it? They will just invoke cliches and tacky metaphors and that sort of thing to practice racism. Victims of white supremacy, myself included, we have been exposed to this misconduct for centuries, decades. We are still learning. Sometimes we don't have all the logic to articulate our views. So for this broadcast, if you need more time to think about your word choice, that's always allowed. However, if we cannot use metaphors, analogies, similes, be exact, precise, direct with what you want to say, that would be appreciated. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, whatever it is, that would be great. Make sure everyone gets at least one chance to speak. And then once everyone has spoken, if you have an additional comment or thought, you can return and share your additional thoughts. Again, we'll be here tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific, Global Sunday Talk. Looking forward to checking in with victims in different parts of the planet. With that, let's see. First few folks who dialed in, if you have questions, thoughts to share, lines should be open. Feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. First off, the nightlife parties going on in L.A., they're also going on here in New York City as well. The sheriff's department shut some down late November last year as well. Also staying on the legal side, the attorney general, I believe her name is Letitia James, filed a lawsuit against the NYPD for using excessive force against Black Lives Matter protesters. think it was just done this Wednesday, so I'm kind of curious to see how this unfolds. I don't really see anything coming out of it, but we'll see how it unfolds. And it's also against the mayor, not only the NYPD, but also against the mayor as well. And just a few things technology-wise for people, because you had a lot of information in regards to technology on this broadcast. Some things that people can actually do to just maintain some kind of security on their home network. One is to just kind of get an understanding of how many devices are actually on your home network. If you create a small little list, then afterwards go into the router, figure out what the router password is actually, change the actual original password and change the router name. And then when you log into the router, you will see a full list of all the actual devices that are on there. And if any device does not match the list that you have, look into it. And if it's not supposed to be there, remove it. That's some of the basics. But there is obviously more, but I don't want to get too deep into that. Going on to the next thing, I finally was successful with food with the family household, vegan dishes. I went and had a Caribbean cookbook and made a vegan soup with butternut squash, sweet yams, regular plain yams, potatoes, carrots, everything. And for once, like, my whole family devoured it. So that worked out great. And I made another dish, which I made a vegan roti dish. Again, the same kind of mixture, but almost you have to create a paste along with the roti bread. And that came out well as well. So getting successful with making some of these vegan dishes to eliminate some of the heavy dairy and meat consumptions in my household. That's been one of the highlights so far this year. Now I just need to make sure we can be consistent with it and keep these meal plans up. One question, Gus, who I missed the individual that you said would be on Monday. Well, who is this person that's going to be on?
Make sure I'm pronouncing. Dotsie Boskin. Bosch, I think that's how you say it. I'll double check for Monday to make sure I have the accurate pronunciation. But yes, Dotsie Bosch, B-A-U-S-C-H. We'll see. But she's a cyclist, advocate, speaker, executive director of the nonprofit Switch for Good, and big time advocate for all the vegan, no dairy. Maybe she'll have some tips on, you know, putting all that dairy stuff down and how to continue to share with family members. But yes, she has her own website, Dotsie Bosch, Plant Powered Athlete. You can check it out and see what she has to say.
All right. Appreciate it.
Congratulations. Peace. Yes, sir. Congratulations. Very excited to hear. Continued. I remember before you said they were pushing back about the vegan, like getting them to be excited about it. Like, there's so many things, like Caribbean cookbooks, and it just depends on what you like to eat. If you're into Asian cuisine, that's easy. Like, it's tons of stuff. A lot of that is really heavy veggie based anyway. So just get a cookbook and explore, have fun, and you can make veggie eating really, really delicious. Like, it should not be something where people are like, oh man, our house is vegan and we just suffer every meal time. You know, we just have steamed carrots and raw cauliflower and broccoli and, oh, dad is the worst. I hate it. Back in the good old days, we get Cheetos and McDonald's. Like, it doesn't have to be that at all. It can be total excitement every time with the soups and pizza or smoothies or whatever you're, you know, attempting to eat. It can be and should be absolutely yummy every time down for meals. Let's see. Mm-hmm. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, if we have parents who are dealing with the whole, I guess, issue of making sure your children are taken care of, healthy and well, that is appreciated as well. Again, I don't have children, so can't really speak to that directly. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Gotta be heard.
Sir, you can go ahead, sir. I'll just wait.
Thank you, sir. DCS program, we had a session today. We continue to put emphasis on safety of the COVID-19 epidemic. It is very much regarded with the program. We seem to have very good cooperation with the parent and or supervisors of the young people that they bring into the program. The parents, you know, gives pretty good assistance in that venture of the COVID-19 safety requirements. And we have about the numbers have went down a little bit over from when the program first started, this session anyway, last year, but it still, you know, goes pretty smooth. Today, and what we have been focusing on is to, instead of us, quote unquote, lecturing the young people in the familiar Eurocentric like means of study and education, where this one person in the front of a quote unquote class would be reading or stating something for a time frame, and whatever that information is, you know, on limited basis and whatnot. And the whole idea is that the recipient, which is the students, basically, that's the only level of knowledge and understanding. So basically what we try to do, we may start a subject matter and have the young guys to report on what they think about things, what they think about that particular incident, or what do they think about this particular subject matter. And we would keep it going by asking questions, by asking them questions. For instance, today, I asked them about the George Floyd incident. And I switched it around by asking them, well, what would be your code? What would be your code? And each participant is required to stand up and speak to everybody about what they think that their code would be. And in order to keep them from being shy about it, I would emphasize where your opinion is your opinion, and we're not going to, quote unquote, tell you are absolutely incorrect on it. You know, glad to make a person shy about stating things. And so the whole idea would be to, you know, listen to what they have to say and then ask questions from it. And, you know, there were some interesting ideas. Some of them were to be expected, such as I would ask, what did you stop me for? And if I didn't get a right answer, I would either walk away or take off running, something like that. And then, you know, that's where I would ask questions about the running part or taking off or that sort of thing, you know, such as, well, what do you expect the outcome to be when you would make that reaction, and don't help me with the answer, you know, that sort of thing. And then they would, you know, start, then it would be a process of to learn, you know, some things. Film-wise, because Monday would be the national identification of the anniversary of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's birth. It's not his birthday. His birthday was back in 1929, but it would be the anniversary that is designated as his birthday. We kind of like broke the chronological order of things that I had been doing with Eyes on the Prize and went to some segments involving him in this quest to neutralize the system of racism and white supremacy. And had a pretty good day. Had a pretty good day. And that's my report. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Thank you, victim, for yielding, sir.
Thank you very much, Gus. I just wanted to say that I really appreciate the retired firefighter. Back when I was a young, well, I don't want to use any metaphors. Back when I was younger, I wanted to be a firefighter, but at the time I didn't have anybody to like mentor me because I actually really needed it. And every time I think about the retired firefighter, sometimes he calls Mr. Fuller's show. And he always asks questions that are like really thought provoking. I would really want to encourage other Kyle's listeners to actually call a Mr. Fuller show too sometimes if you can, because it helps to make the discussions more broader and then you have people who are codified. And also I wanted to say something about, I actually forgot what I was going to say, but I really wanted to say what I wanted to say about the retired firefighter. Fred, I really appreciate him. Thank you.
Much obliged, victim of racism. Let's see. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Other folks that we missed totally, if you have a hand up and we've not heard from you at all, line should be open. Proceed. Folks are getting their thoughts together, I guess, maybe sulking about the last few days of the Trump administration. Again, we'll be here tomorrow for our Global Sunday Talk. Monday, Dotsie Bosch. I have to double check to see about Mr. Dershowitz, because that might even be Wednesday. So we might have a brief interim on Tuesday and then be right back. But I have to double check, check to confirm if that Wednesday date and time will be sufficient for everyone. But moving through all of that, let's see. The report on there were a number of reports that I did not play that I did think were important from this week, but you can't play everything. The report about the violence leading up to the inauguration this week, that's another one that I thought was appalling. If they had any idea, let's say it was Black Lives Matter, not effing around, or whatever it is, not effing around group, if they were planning to go to D.C., the Black Identity, pick any organization you want, even if it was COWS, let's say it was we were going to do a rowdy counter-racist yoga retreat in D.C. for the inauguration, and they had notions that, oh man, Gus and these folks might come here and get really radical, you know, stir up some trouble for Biden and folks. You're going to tell me you're going to be this lackluster? I'm like, ooh, just have to be on alert. We'll have to see. They would be making you talk about no-knock search warrants and such. Like, oh my God. Like, COINTELPRO 2.0 or 2.0, 3.0, whatever you want to call it. Like, it would be total by any means necessary, whatever needs to be done to secure our democracy, safety, make sure that no more lawlessness, vandalism takes place. That would be the response, not, wow, hopefully things will go well. We're on high alert. We'll have to see. We're guarding social media. Like, come on. Incidentally, again, I would not be in the D.C. area. I know we have folks, the DMV area. I would not be at the inauguration. I would not want to be in the D.C. area unless I had to be there for, like, work purposes, school purposes, whatever the case may be. If it's not that, no thanks. I would expect all kinds of armed white people, if it's enforcement officers, military personnel, protesters, Proud Boys, whatever it is, I would expect lots of that. And if I am not there, knowing my code, I can handle all of that easily. If that's not the case, I am good. Let's see. Folks, get their thoughts together yet? Still spectating?
Can I be heard?
Caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to us, the host, the listeners and callers. Yeah, I definitely agree with that, the difference in response, because of the footage that I've been seeing from the various news stations. Just by my observation, it just feels like they just show the National Guards people, a lot of them white men, just laying down like they're taking a nap, not taking it seriously. You know, I'm correlating that to, they know the threat and the target that they've been asked to be faced with is white people. And there was another segment where the guy, he was being totally surrounded. They had a, you know, as many people on the line may have seen, a white guy, I guess a law enforcement official, trapped in a door screaming for help or whatever. You know, it was one guy, he said, you know, I was about to take out my gun, firearm, and I could have killed a lot of them or something to that nature. But, you know, I had to sit and think, it would have proven them right. It would have justified. I'm like, wow, he stayed with the racist code and still find a way to rationalize the hostility that they came with that day. And I also heard on the audio segment, because I heard also people were trying to just say it's just white men. Yeah, it might be a large portion of white men. But hey, that Jenna Ryan lady, I think that was her, that was saying, if it's going to be a war, I'm going to be right in the front line. So, I mean, they're showing that dedication, and they are heavily involved in different professions. Real estate, some of them are in law enforcement, military, and they have all of these different groups, Oath Keepers, and I don't even know if they mentioned that alt-right, Richard Spencer, all of that pretty much in the same category, Boogaloo and things like that. They don't seem to be as alert as they're thinking about Black Lives Matter. And I saw one that ended out, they just had one of those ankle bracelet things on a guy, I guess he was from around in my area. And it didn't look like he pretty much got a serious punishment, like some kind of a misdemeanor. He may have gotten fired or whatever, but they still are classified as white. They have a complete group of white people that are their backup support to help them get out of any kind of serious trouble. So definitely something to keep mind of. And thank you for the information shared. And I'll pass it on to the next person. Thank you.
Much obliged. Caller in Florida. It is not white male supremacy. I think I had to point that out. I don't know if it was last week. It was recently. They just had one of those reports, same thing, talking about the terrorism at the Capitol. And they said it was white men, armed white men, savage white men. And then they went right and talked to a white woman. Said, oh, yes. MAGA, we've got to do it. They stole the election. And they did the same thing this week. Now, I don't remember them saying that it was just white men. But exactly as he said, they went and talked to that white woman. I'm going to be on the front lines. Blood has to be shed. I'm right. Come on. And it was repeated shots of that, of white women out there saying with the exact same type of sentiment. I'm armed. I'm ready to roll. White men do not have to carry this burden by themselves. Dedicate white men and white women. You can't have a system of racism, white supremacy, without equal participation from both parties. So I thought that was supremely important throughout all of this, because they've done a really skillful job, as they normally do, of just isolating it and white men. I've seen way too many pictures of white men. Even the former, she's about to be out of there, Senator Loeffler in Georgia. She was one of the ones. Matter of fact, I even saw a report this week. They were talking about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's wife, Cowbell, that she was also one of the ones encouraging all of this. And, oh, they stole the erection. Get out there and make your voice heard. Speak out. Like, white women have been a crucial supporter of Mr. Trump. And they have been a vital cog in all of the madness. Probably will continue to be, even, you know, as the inauguration goes on. I have to double check what day the inauguration actually is. Let's see if I can, unless we're already on and doing something, maybe we'll do some coverage, live coverage of the inauguration, especially if they, you know, cut a fool and there begins to be some violence or what have you. Maybe we'll do a live broadcast, but I'll double check the date and time and all that, and we shall see. We did that for Obama. I don't think this will be nearly as entertaining. That was a blessed day for Gusty Renegade, watching Obama depart the White House. Like, wow. Do not get many jolly days on the plantation, but that was good times. I don't think it'll be that way this time around, but we'll see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, observations, lines should be open. Proceed. Do we not have, are the parents spectating? I know I did say something about that. I cannot imagine that we have this many people tuning in and we have zero parents and or none of the parents checked in on the well-being of their children. I'm very certain I did ask that question before that. That's just, you know, we don't care about that question, Gus, moving on to other things. No problem. But I did think that was kind of important, mental and well-being of, you know, non-white offspring. We had parents who did talk about that yesterday, and I said there was going to be a clip on that today. So is that correct? Either we have no parents, or the parents that we do have don't care about that.
Greetings, Gus.
Yes, sir.
Ignorant parent here. What was the question that you had for the parents?
Ignorant host too. Let's see. The question was for parents. We had a report today, and then we had people actually brought it up voluntarily yesterday that they said, man, the whole COVID situation has had a big impact, non-constructive impact on our offspring. We're seeing it in their grades, where they were spectacular before, making all A's, and now their grades have dropped a little bit, or they just seem a little down, depressed, where I can see it's having an impact on them, where they're not able to get up and go see their friends every day, or having to stay in front of the screen. Just have people seeing how this mass disruption has impacted their children, and what steps are we taking to try to check in on that, mitigate that to some degree.
Okay, I think that's why the program still, the DCS program still operating for that very reason, is that you have a core level of parents who are concerned about that, because the whole advent of the COVID. It probably affects their child or children in the school, which is normally is something that, you know, once the child goes off to school and the parent goes off to work, you know, the parent kind of like, you know, as a parent, you don't worry about so much the safety of your child and or the level of social interaction that that child has. If anything, it may be concerned of being too much, you know, as far as the social aspect, you know, without the pandemic. But so that's why some of them probably still bring their child out there to that school. You know, schools are closed on Saturdays, but that school on those Saturdays with their child, or in some case children. And even with my offspring, he and I have like a code where I constantly remind him of the advent. Of course, he's more sociable than I am, you know, with a big difference in age, and he has, you know, social interaction. He's about to leave the house now. But I keep it a reminder of him as far as the code of safety on the COVID, you know, as far as the potential of him bringing it into our safety zone, which is the house. I'm not around him. It's like I'm like not around him when he leaves out of here. But I would say probably so far that things are going functional in that light. So it is a task that has to be paid attention to and consult with each other on, you know, at the advent of the attempted parent and the offspring, just like you would with anybody else within that environment. You know, it just so happens that person is a little bit younger, and the different types of relationship that you have with that person. In this case, attempted parent / offspring, and you know, you basically, you know, share in the best qualified manner that you possibly can with that person to keep things in a workable output, so to speak. But yeah, those are my thoughts on that. Hopefully I made some sense. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Commendations as well for keeping the DCS program rolling. I'm sure for some parents that is exactly why they have continued to be enrolled and show up on the Saturdays, so they can get that social component, get outside, get away from the screen a little bit, like all of that is in addition to everything else, get some time learning about counter-racism and all the rest of it. Like, that is super important. I would encourage if you are a parent, or in your case, these are Black children that aren't even yours, so-called biologically, but still being able to have an impact in a constructive way. So just check in, just asking some questions, seeing how they're doing, invest a little bit of your time. As I said, this whole Rona situation and everything else has had a big impact on all of us. It has not missed young folks. So check in, see how they're doing. And even just remembering, being a younger person, a lot of the things that were a big deal then, being able to go and hang out with your friends, or the sporting activities, if you're on a football team or basketball team, track, whatever it is, missing out on a lot of that stuff or having it greatly compromised is a big deal. So check in, see how they're doing, do the best you can. Black mental health, man, for older people and younger people, Black mental health. Do we have any other attempted parents been checking on the welfare of their offspring?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I spoke before, but this was something I actually brought up yesterday as well. And it is difficult, but I've noticed the main things to really do is to try to keep them active, even at home. So I bought a chess board so you can actually play chess, and a Monopoly board and things of that nature. And whenever you have the time, it's best to just sit down with them and not watch TV unless it's something that you can discuss, where you could talk about the incidents or the storyline and how it relates to them. If it's nothing that you could discuss with them, don't even bother watching TV when you have that spare time. Invest in actually playing a board game with them and having a conversation about anything they want to talk about, whether it be cartoon characters or whatever. But if you could keep it more closely related to what's going on, it's better. Also, just going outside. I got a mountain bike so we can go outside and still ride, even though up here in the Northeast it's cold. But it's something that, to me, is just mandatory. So those are the steps that I've been taking, and trying to get him to cook along with me now is another one, too. Also, a side note, something you just mentioned, I don't know if you've seen this, but you may see this and other listeners may have seen it, is that the secrets, the FBI and the New Jersey law enforcement sheriff was just at the head of the new Black Panther Foundation. They were just at his home, and he recorded the whole entire incident, and they were asking him, were you a part or contributing to the violence that took place at the Capitol? And he made sure he put it on camera so everybody could see, like, as you know, introducing all the police officers, all the officers and officials there, and then stated in front of them, no, I was not a part of it. We have no connection with any right-wing groups that would prefer it to be so. Please leave my residence. And that was it, what he closed off with there. But I thought that was interesting when you just mentioned that, because that is something that I think is occurring across the country more frequently than we could probably imagine. I'll mute my line.
Oh, yeah. All the video that I have seen from the Capitol in the last week, I saw lots of new Black Panther Party members out in the streets of D.C. and in the Capitol building, breaking window. Like, it was just rife. New Black Panther Party members, logos, all over the place. Like, they darn near invaded D.C. I'm sure there had to be a new Black Panther Party bus, chartered plane to get all of those black people there and their signs. That's what I said. Not that I'm surprised or stunned. I'll repeat what I said. If I was a black person, Neely Fuller Jr., like, ooh-wee, I would be. I think he's been doing the whole Rona thing, so I'm pretty sure he's been in the house anyway. But, man, I would be in the house. Sabrina Johnson, I would be in the house. Dr. Rasayan, I would be in the house. All the other folks who I know who are in that D.C. DMV area, Emmy, the rest, I would be in the house. We'll have to kick it in D.C. like, I don't know, maybe we'll do it for the Cherry Blossom Festival. Maybe things will have settled down by springtime, then we can go back and kick it in D.C. But for the foreseeable future, at least for the winter, I'm going to pass on that one. And then the audacity that that's exactly, I had said that earlier, didn't I? Talk about no-knock warrants. If it was black identity extremists, if it was the no effing around group had their signs and they were going to do their parade and march in D.C. like, oh, my goodness, we wouldn't even be having this discussion. The jails would be stuffed and we'd be talking about making sure we could send Rona masks to all the black people who've been locked up for charges for last week. Guantanamo Bay style. 720-716-7300 metaphor there, Guantanamo Bay style. Intense, maybe even not charged, detained, greater confinement. Tortured even, maybe. Number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you have other thoughts, observations to share, certainly if we have parents, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Mo in Dallas. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, listeners and callers. Thank you for the program. In response to your parent comment, I have actively been checking on the mental welfare of my children. I'm an attempted parent of two offspring, one young male, one young female. It is difficult with the distant learning. I've seen a drop in my students' grades since this Rona thing has you know been an issue, and I've made it I made a point not to send them back to school, and it's kind of hard just because the amount of just non-care from the teachers. My daughter has been living with me for the majority of her life, and with her distant learning situation, it's like a lot of the times her assignments aren't uploaded, but she's still, you know, they still count against her. And I sit with her sometimes, and we talk to the teacher together, you know, explaining that, you know, the task, like, I'll give you an example. Like, she's assigned an article to read, and the article comes with a quiz, and the link is supposed to be at the bottom of the article. But a lot of times her links aren't there, you know, and the teacher's just, you know, well, we'll get to it later. And that does a number on her comprehension, because, like, a lot of times when the quiz is available, the article isn't, you know. So, like, just kind of getting her to take notes on critical things in articles like that, you know, it's kind of hard, being that she is, you know, very young, not even a preteen yet. So, you know, her attention span is very short. So, with my son, it's kind of the same thing, but he doesn't live with me. So he does have like a cellular device. I was against it, but he still got it. But what he does do now is he calls me and gets assistance with his work, you know, and that's kind of difficult in itself, because then he might get in trouble for being on the phone in class, you know. So it's a whole, that's a thing in itself. Now, with my children not being able to, you know, play with friends or whatever, it has been a struggle. So I find myself involved with them more. You know, I'll try to be as involved as I, you know, as I should, but I work two jobs. So, you know, that's kind of hard. But I did hang a tire swing, though. So that was interesting. And a lot of my neighbors thought it was cool, you know. So we make sure to clean it and give access to other children. So if their parents, you know, want to come out and play with the tire swing, they can. Things like that. And I'm lucky that I have that my children, you know, do have a sibling to play with. They're also just clean by nature. Like, you know, they love bathing and keeping their hands clean. So that's not an issue. They were kind of brought up that way. So that kind of worked to our benefit. But it has been very, very difficult with them not being able to actually physically go to school. It's kind of, you kind of have to, like the previous caller stated, you kind of have to force them outside. You have to force them to use their brains now, because, you know, it used to be, you know, not an option to go outside and get fresh air. Now, since everything's in the home, you know, like I took my children to the lake, and my son was like, why? And I was like, air, son, like air and sun. We're going to try some of this. It's actually quite nice. And he enjoyed himself, but it's kind of promoting a mindset of, I don't have to leave the house with my children. You know, that's the kind of, I've noticed that they have that kind of ideology in a sense. I want to say my son more than my daughter. He's a little older, you know, everything he likes is in the house, his game or whatever. So I had to get different things. I got him a scooter, got her roller skates. My daughter also has a bike. My son has a bike, but it's at home. I do my due diligence in trying to keep them active, as well as, you know, thinking. We play chess, checkers. We just played Uno. We have a lot of board games. We do jigsaw puzzles. So, and it kind of gives us an excuse to find new things to do. And I allow them to participate, you know. It's not just me buying old games or whatever. I ask them what they would like to do. My son just got, I think, 100 water balloon grenades that he can't use right now, but we're going to find something to do with them. So, like, it's interesting, and it's just, you know, I got 100 water balloons, but I can't play with kids, or they can't play with children, so we got to figure that out. But it's just things like that really kind of, you know, stifle their social skills, if you will, if that makes any sense. They can't really talk to the kids in the class. Everybody's on mute. Another short thing about the Capitol. I don't know if this was brought up. I did come into the program late. I did notice that a lot of the non-white people in the Capitol building had some very interesting stories. I think Ayanna Pressley, in an article, stated that the panic button was removed from her office. And I want to say that was James Clyburn said that his secret office was disclosed to the individuals that actually raided the Capitol. He had an office with his name on the door, and I might be mistaken. It might not have been James Clyburn, but it was a black male who said that he has an office with his name labeled, and he has another office that he works in, and the insurrectionists, domestic terrorists, went to the unknown office, like, directly. Like, so I thought that was very interesting. That's all I have on mute my line.
Wow. That I'd heard that some of the black Capitol workers, because a little bit of that was included in the audio segment, with some of the black Capitol police officers, were talking about seeing some of their white officers in the mob and being called a nigger during all of this. It's not funny. I'm just, you know. But they talked about some of that. So, yes, I would, man, if I can find any information, Representative James Clyburn in South Carolina, Pitchfork Ben Tillman's South Carolina, Dylan Storm Roof's South Carolina. Let's see. I'm looking at the news now to see if I can find any information on that. It might take me a little bit of time to, yeah, see if I can find an exact report. Once I do, I will definitely share, but I'm not surprised at all. Now imagine the new Black Panther Party not effing around. Al Sharpton, even somehow they have breached security at the Capitol, and now they have Nancy Pelosi's, you know, secret office or bunker. You know, things have gotten bad. Imagine such a thing. Come on.
Dust, can I add something?
Yes, sir.
I found Representative Ayanna Pressley's, her ad in CBS Boston, where she was, the headline says, "All panic buttons in Rep. Ayanna Pressley's office ripped out before Capitol riot." That's the headline. I just Googled Pressley panic button, and that article came up. I'll see if I can find the other one about the secret office. But that's on CBS Boston, WBZ4.
Wow. I guess just for, I don't know what you would call it, comparison, because I was checking for James Clyburn first. I'll get the Ayanna Pressley report as well, but I was checking for Mr. Clyburn. And the report that came up with the most mentions for this week, and in fact, the last 24 hours or so, in active healing, Representative James Clyburn calls for making Black National Anthem a national hymn and or making that song Lift Every Voice and Sing, making that the new national anthem. VGQ, you know, that's his suggestion. VGQ. But, well, I guess one point, you talk about civil war. That's a phrase I've heard a lot this week. You think people are upset, white people are upset about Colin Kaepernick or Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson or anybody else taking a knee during the national anthem. You want to see white vigilante pitchfork Ben Tillman style mob violence change the national anthem to Lift Every Voice. Like, oh my gosh, like I shouldn't be like you. Talk about total white anarchy. We're going out for the World Series. Man, come on. Come on. We're going out to start the World Series. And now we'll have Alicia Keys to sing the national anthem, cowbell. Lift Every Voice. And man. New Civil War. I don't think that would solve it. Even if it wasn't a Civil War. I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
I did find an article for Jim Clyburn. It's by a Washington Examiner, published on January 8, 2021. Headline is Jim Clyburn suggests Capitol rioters new to target specific offices. Something else was going on. That's the headline in the Washington Examiner. Sorry to cut you off.
Wow. Fascinating. I will. Oh, no. Oh, well, this is 2-0 no's. So I found those reports. However, I also found the same article listed in the New York Post. I had to say, oh, no, because both of these are publications that I generally do not view as trustworthy for various reasons. Not that they are necessarily bad all the time, and they do have accurate information sometimes, but generally these would not be, like, if it was information that I was going to take forward to somebody, it would not be from the Post or the Examiner. But they do have accurate information. I say bless it, like I would never share anything from the Washington Examiner. The New York Post I have sometimes, but the Washington Examiner, like, no way. But they do have it. Let's see what the New York Post says. I'll check the other one. The New York Post, their report, Representative James Clyburn suggests Capitol rioters may have had inside intel. Representative Clyburn said Sunday he believes the Capitol rioters may have had inside information, noting that the mob somehow find his office despite there being no sign on the door. I have an unmarked office that you have got to know exactly where it is, Clyburn told CNN anchor Jake Tapper on State of the Union. The House Majority Whip said that he spends most of his time in that office instead of a second one, which does have signage above the door, indicating that it's his. They didn't go to where my name was. They went to where I usually hang out. That, to me, indicates that something untoward may have been going on. The South Carolina Democrat previously suggested that there may have been people in the Capitol building who were complicit in helping the rioters. They knew where to go, I've been told by some others in Congress. People that their staff are saying that they saw people being allowed into the building through side doors. Who opened those side doors for the protesters? Or I call these mobsters to come into the building, not through the main entrance where magnameters are, but through side doors. Yes, somebody on the inside of those buildings were complicit. Would have to be. That makes sense. I'll post this one, even though, like I said, but I'll post this one. Logical, very logical. Mobsters. We say all the time, or I say, I think Mr. Fuller has it as well, the gangsters, the number one gangsters in the known universe, racist man, racist woman, racist child. Not even close. But yet and still, I probably wouldn't call these folks mobs. VGQ, no criticism from Mr. Clymer. Just saying, words are important. I probably wouldn't call these folks mobsters. Would probably have to be stronger language. Definitely criminal. Mobsters are for sure criminal. But mobsters are like glorified. See, that's the thing. That would be a reason why I'd have to shy away from that. Like, we glorify gang. Everybody loves the Godfather, right? Right? They pick nicknames and such after gangsters. Everybody loves Scarface, right? Lucky Luciano, we love these folks. So, yeah, we don't want to pick gangsters. And then sometimes the gangsters, they get so good, they become senators and president and all the rest. So we don't want to go gangster. Terrorists. Treasonous white terrorists. Nothing to be celebrated there. Other folks, commentary, if they want to get in. We have about 15 minutes left in the broadcast. Bay Area mom, did you have commentary? You should be with us.
Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, super. Thank you again. Greetings to everyone on the line and listening. So I do have a child as well. He's an adult male. He's in college. he told me he went to the campus. It's so different because, of course, you know, in March when they made all the kids just beat it, everything was everywhere. His stuff was everywhere. So when he got back into the state, he had to retrieve his stuff from wherever it went. One of his friends that live in New York had some of his stuff. And so she went back on campus. Well, she lives on campus. And he went to get his stuff. So the dorms have changed. It's basically one. Yeah, you might get two people in the dorm, but you can't have company. In the elevator, only one person at a time. Now, keep in mind, this is a private music college, so a lot of these children have instruments. So you literally have to wait in line or take the stairs or however you would get, wherever you're going to get. So that's going to be complicated. When school starts back, I guess next week or the week after. It's like an assembly line. However, you gotta make sure you stay 6 feet, away from everything and everyone. Then they're policing you and they're making the students police each other. So if you see anyone out of order, you make sure you tell. And no parties, none of that stuff, and anything out of order, you tell. Someone's got their mask, trying to breathe, covering under their mouth instead of covering their nose, you better report them. So that kind of thing. So for him, he was so excited to be on campus 2019. Whoa, so here it is, 21. He's not excited, so it's good that he has his own space. As far as socializing, he had friends and stuff, you know, but he would only go out if it was like maybe a prom or something like that, something major. He's not an outer like that. He doesn't really roam, or he's not a typical teenager, so he's more into his agenda. And since his music, a lot of his stuff is digital online, I think one of his things is electronic production and design. So for him, it's fine. As far as online learning, at March, especially trying to complete it until June, it was awful because the instrument and the facility, it's much needed to do the work. So it was hard to maintain his grades. Now, he's not going to go below A. So that never happened. But now he's picked classes that will work with being sheltered in place. So because he went back to the state where his school is, he has access to the instrument, so he can knock some of that out, some of those things that require the major instruments that he doesn't own. He can utilize that just to knock out everything, because I think school will be over in May. It's interesting, but for him, it's not. It's just strange. So he had to get tested for this virus yesterday. So I'm agitated, and he's agitated, but because I don't want anything in his nose. So, and he sounded like somebody stuck something in his nose too when I talked to him yesterday. So then I called him today, and he sounded a little clearer. I keep him in the loop as far as whatever supplements to take and seeing your nose, Neosporin, and I do the best that I can to make sure he's taking care of himself. And we just will have to see. But with the report, I did hear about the congressman because he was talking about it, and he was you didn't think it was going to happen, then it happened. And then to take the panic buttons out, the way they're going to switch this around, and it's going to really hit us hard. Oh dear. It's going to hit us hard. All of this is going on now, but they're going to hit us. Just like they said, they went to the gentleman had spoken, said they went to, what is it? Black Panther Party guy's house. They're going to do that. It's going to be hard for us. They're light footing with the other. They're soft. They're very soft with the white people, but with us, they're going to hit hard with these new rules and everything that they put into place. And I'll mute my line. And thank you for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am. Safety to you and your offspring. You said your son, he had to be tested. There's no requirement for the vaccine that you know about currently. They just had to get tested.
He's not on campus.
Okay.
So he has to get tested to pass through.
Okay.
In order to live on campus, you must get the vaccine.
Oh, okay. Very important. Yes, I would probably be happy to be off campus too then to avoid all of that. And I'd probably still be a little salty, as the young folks say, about having to do the test. But I guess I could probably mitigate that a lot better than the vaccine. So, yeah, that's right on. Hope he stays safe and has a great scholarly academic year. Yeah, and Brad, that's, you just try to do the best that you can and share information, you know, for him to take it seriously. And that's about all you can do. Share information and encourage them to take it safely and to not have guests and such, just to be about your business, I guess. To have to live on campus, that whole environment, like you can only have so many people on the elevator, and I've read the reports where you can only have so many people in like the bathroom area, the shower area, and the snitching is encouraged. Like, oh, you didn't cover your mouth when you sneezed, up, call him on campus security. He covered his nose. I mean, wow, that is does not sound like fun times in higher ed. Do we have other folks, any final comments that want to make sure they get in before we conclude? We will be here Sunday, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. Global Sunday Talk on Racism. Any final thoughts folks want to share? Clap. Got everyone? Grand. As I said, we'll be here tomorrow and Monday. Have to check to see if we will be able to have Mr. Dershowitz with us. That would be a strong illustration, the challenge of having white guests on. We could always have other victims of white supremacy on and, you know, gripe and fuss at them and name call for how they have responded to the system of racism. We could do that. I don't see that that solves many problems, but that's always available. Or we could talk to the folks who are causing the problem, or at least suspected of causing the problem. Now, you have someone like Alan Dershowitz, like, wow, just the O.J. Simpson trial. He was right there. So lots of information, you know, to glean from that whole situation. Then he's been involved with so many other high profile cases. Like I said, Trump's impeachment. And in fact, I even forgot he just was out and he was talking about the vaccines. He was talking about mandatory vaccines for everybody and saying that that should be the logical course. It's in the interest of public safety to just everybody go ahead and everybody get the vaccine and we can be over and done with it. And, you know, what did I say before? Civil War. I think you would have tons of individuals classified as white who would be furious about that. And, you know, over my cold, dead hand. Isn't that what he said? Yeah, but it would be so many things that to discuss, to address, to examine, to ask questions, just, you know, him being an attorney in general to ask questions about, as opposed to squabbling with other victims of white supremacy. And we don't agree with how they're responding or they don't agree with how we're responding. Victims guaranteed qualified. No problem. Let's focus on the problem, try to learn constructive information and get this here system of racism vanquished immediately. Much obliged, everyone, for their participation. Hope it was a constructive use of your Saturday evening. Again, we will be here tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Monday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. White woman, white people returning to the cows. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, especially like with everything that's happening right now. You really want to have your brain computer working at a highly efficient level. We will need like high level thinking, high level problem solving to deal with all of this madness and just to try to ascertain what is actually happening. So, and in addition, so many reasons, in addition, you do not want to be out and about and suddenly you are stopped and confronted, enforcement official, badge or no, and now you are not thinking correctly because of what you have imbibed or whatever it is. Like, let's really be about being sober, clear thinking, as they say. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled if we're going to be out and about. I would encourage hunkering down. If you're going out for something constructive, you're taking your children out to get a little air, you're going to do an errand that's, you know, essential, you're going to work, whatever it is, all well and good. While we're doing these things, be very alert of what's happening around you. If it looks like anything looks suspicious, anything looks untoward, let's get out of here. Not taking any chances, particularly if it looks like somebody is being loud, they're escalating. We should be thinking like, hey, this person could be armed. Molotov cocktail, firearm, explosive. Who knows? This person, in fact, might have a whole gang of individuals classified as white with them ready for violence. I would say most of us probably did not leave our residence prepared for mortal combat. As such, like, let's get out of here. We are not hanging around and, you know, trying to be loud and rowdy with some random stranger with everything that's happening currently. So we are sober. We're hunkering down. But if we got to go out, we're buckled. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone. Again, just trying to do the small things to minimize contact with the Mark Furmans of the known universe. Some of them, Mark Furman, wouldn't be surprised if he was one of the ones at the Capitol. We are just trying to remain, be mindful. We don't have all the energy to be on the cell phone and texting and all of that and remain aware of what's happening around us. Text when we get home. That's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.